Back. We're going to return to MDU's case in chief here. Mr. Sanderson.
Thank you, Judge. Montana Dakota would call Jordan Hutzenbuehler.
Mr. Hutzenbuehler, spell your first and last name for the record, please.
J-O-R-D-A-N-H-A-T-Z-E-N-B-U-H-L-E-R.
Hey, raise your right hand, please. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Thank you. Mr. Sanderson.
Thank you. Mr. Hutzenbuehler, can you please state your full name and business address?
My name is Jordan Hutzenbuehler. My business address is 400 North 4th Street here in Bismarck, North Dakota.
And whom are you employed by?
I'm employed by Montana Dakota Utilities Company.
And what is your position with the company?
I'm a senior regulatory analyst.
And can you briefly describe what you do in that role?
My primary duties, particularly in relation to rate cases such as this, are the preparation of embedded class cost of service studies, the development of rate design, the allocation of the revenue requirement, and additionally, I prepare miscellaneous other filings on behalf of the company.
And could you briefly give a brief background of your education and work experience?
Yes. I have a Bachelor's of Science degree in accounting from the University of North Dakota. I'm also a CPA. I have worked for the MDU Resources group of companies for just under 8 years in my current role for about 3 years.
And have you testified in other proceedings before state regulatory bodies?
Yes, I have.
Okay. And are you familiar with Montana Dakota's application for natural gas rate increase in this case?
Yes, I am.
And could you briefly describe your involvement in the application?
As I mentioned previously, I prepared the company's embedded class cost of service study. I developed the allocation of the revenue increase, as well as did the development of the rate design.
And did you also submit pre-filed direct and rebuttal testimony?
Yes, I did.
And if asked the same questions, would your answers remain the same?
Yes, they would.
Have you also prepared PowerPoint slides regarding your areas of testimony today?
I have.
And if, as you move along in your presentation, feel free to use those. First off, could you just explain the effect the recent Tax Act had on your calculations?
Yes. As seen on the slide, the tax reform had a substantial impact on our request in this proceeding. It was mentioned a number of times yesterday, but as seen here, the revenue shortfall, or our ask, was decreased by over $2 million, about $2.3 million, nearly a 40% reduction in the ask overall. So instead of a proposed overall increase in rates of 5.4%, we're now looking at a 3.3% overall increase. And for residential, for the residential class, we've gone from a 5.9% as filed increase down to a 3.6% increase. Again, a meaningful benefit to our customers as a result of that tax reform. And I'd just like to note that any numbers that I use going forward are going to reflect the adjustments that were taken into account with regard to the tax reform.
And now, could you describe the purpose or explain the purpose of conducting a class cost of service study?
Yes. The class study serves a number of purposes. First and foremost, it provides a basis for measuring the rate of return provided by each rate class. From there, it serves as a guide for allocating the revenue increase to the rate classes, as well as guiding the rate designs applicable to each customer class.
And can you explain the company's embedded class cost of service study and the results used in this case?
Yes. As seen on this slide, the results of the embedded class study indicate that the rate of return provided by the residential class and the firm general class as a whole are under-returning. They're not yielding the authorized rate of return, while the remaining classes, Air Force and the interruptible classes, are all exceeding the authorized return. So what it means is that the residential class and the small firm classes are not providing enough dollars to cover the cost to serve them while the remaining classes are.
Can you explain how the company determined what cost should be allocated to each customer class?
Yes. In determining what cost should be allocated to each customer class, it's basically a three-step process to complete an embedded class cost of service study. The first step would be to functionalize and classify the revenue requirement, the entire revenue requirement, as costs. When you functionalize it, you do so into costs that are either production or transmission or distribution in nature. In a case like this one, for a distribution gas utility, this step is very simple, as all costs are functionalized as distribution costs. From there, we classify those costs into three buckets, essentially. We have customer-related, demand-related, and energy-related costs. So customer costs are going to be those that vary with the level of customers. Energy costs would be those that vary with the level of energy consumption. And demand costs would be those that vary with the demand imposed by the customer.
And in this case, AARP and staff have asserted in their testimony that distribution mains should be allocated as a 100% demand-related cost. Do you agree with this position?
In a distribution case like this one, the classification of distribution mains is a primary cost driver, and as such, it's often a contested area, as there are multiple ways to allocate the costs. I do not agree with the recommendation of allocating mains as 100% demand for one overriding reason, and that is that it ignores that there are two primary drivers or cost causers for that investment, and that is the fact that there are, in fact, customers that are joining the system and they have the associated demand on the system. And to allocate 100% on demand ignores the fact, that first fact, that it takes customers to have a demand component.
And one of the things we know, the revenue allocation and between the classes is not in dispute with AARP or staff in this case.
That is correct. It's an important thing to note. As was mentioned by Mr. Rubin, we may not have got there in the same way. We had differing views regarding the allocation of mains or other methodology issues. But everybody agrees that what the company proposed in terms of the allocation of the revenue increase is appropriate and reasonable.
Can you explain the total revenue effect of the proposed gas rate change?
Yes. So as seen on the slide here, the total revenue effect in this case is a proposed increase of approximately $3.6 million or 3.3% over current rates. As you can see in the proposed increase column there, about $2.1 million has been allocated to the residential class, with about just under $1.5 million allocated to the firm general class. So that increase to the residential class represents approximately 3.6%. And then on the far right of the side, you can see what the results are in terms of what each class is returning in terms of a rate of return on rate base, both before the increase that's proposed as well as after. So in the top right corner, you can see that after the increase, residential class, we're moving it towards cost because it ends up with a rate of return at 5.7%, but still below the requested ROR of 7.5, roughly.
And can you explain how the proposed increase will be allocated to the customers and the effect it will have on the typical residential customer bill?
Yes. Again, the increase has been allocated to the residential and firm classes. Residential customers currently have a simple two-part rate that was just adopted and approved by the commission less than 3 years ago. Customers pay a one fixed rate to have access to North American gas fields that are inexpensive, and then they have one variable rate for the cost of gas that's actually used. It's very simple to understand. And we think it's worked well. The increase will be applied entirely to that fixed charge, and it'll amount to about $1.82 per month as proposed. And so that increase will be the same whether you're a low-use customer for any reason or a high-use customer. With that increase, approximately 60% of the bill remains volumetric, thus maintaining the incentive to conserve or to achieve efficiencies that ultimately conserve your energy and the desired price signal of use less, pay less, use more, pay more. And just for reference, one decatherm saved over the course of the year results in a saving of over $4 just due to that cost of gas, the commodity cost. So that's how the increase will be applied to the residential class. The firm class will receive an increase in their customer charges. Again, the cost of service study was used as a guide to bring those more in line with the cost to serve them. And the remaining needed increase will be picked up through the volumetric energy charge. And the monthly increases are shown there on the slide for both the small and firm classes. And additionally, using the class study as a guide, we increased the customer charges for both the small and large IT classes. Now, if you recall on the previous slide here, there was no allocated increase to small interruptible or large interruptible, but you'll see that in the proposed increase, there's very small amounts, negative $171 for small IT, $139 for large IT. So the reason that there's that marginal increase and decrease is that we adjusted the basic service charges for those classes. But to remain revenue neutral, their energy charges were reduced. So it's just due to rounding that there's a couple hundred dollars for each of those. So those are all of the proposed changes to rates. And this next slide here is just a detailed look at the proposed residential typical or average bill by month for a 91 DK average residential customer. As you can see, it shows the total increase of just under $22 for a year, comes out to about $1.82 a month. And you'll see that the cost of gas, those columns are not changing. It's strictly into the basic service charge columns.
And you mentioned in MDU's last natural gas rate case, this commission approved a straight fixed variable rate design for the residential rate class. Can you just explain the benefits of this rate design?
Yes, there are a number of benefits to the customer specifically with regard to this rate design. The first one I have listed here is a big one in that was realized this past winter. We had a substantially colder heating season this past winter, and the straight fixed variable design kind of mitigates automatically to an extent the impact of that abnormal weather without the need of some other mechanism to normalize like we had in the past. So that's an important one, not only to the customer, but then it also has a benefit to the company of providing some stability in terms of our revenues in circumstances where weather is very abnormal. Along those lines, it provides for a more stable bill with a greater portion of the bill being fixed for the customer, so they have a better idea of what to expect, while also maintaining the incentive to conserve with roughly, as I said, 60% of the bill remaining volumetric. To Chairman Crispin's point yesterday regarding customers that may have a gas service to a lake cabin that is used only seasonally or infrequently, or customers that take gas service strictly for a gas fireplace or a fire pit outside, or geothermal customers that we serve as the backup energy source for them during times of peak. Under a rate design that recovers the fixed cost to serve those customers through volumetric charges, there are obvious subsidies that take place at the expense of the other customers. The current rate design addresses these issues just by default, automatically. Lastly, it appropriately allows fixed costs to be recovered through a fixed charge.
Mr. Hudson-Buehler, I have no further questions. Thank you. At this time, Judge, we'd offer MDU Exhibit 15, the PowerPoint slides of this presentation.
Any objections?
Objection.
No objection.
Okay.
Objection.
Okay. MDU 15 is received. Mr. Armstrong.
No questions.
Mr. Kaufman.
Yes, I have a couple. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Hartson-Bueller. Let me just start by asking you questions based on your slides here.
Okay.
Could you go to slide 11, where you're showing the proposed residential changes? And
I have different slide numbers up here.
Well, there you go. Now, this slide shows the average residential customer, I assume?
That is correct.
Okay. And did you review Mr. Rubin's testimony?
I did.
In this case, do you agree with him that only about 30% of residential customers use 90 decatherms or more on an annual basis?
Yes, that appeared correct.
Okay. And you understand the difference between the mean and the median?
Yes.
And so if we're talking about the median residential customer, they may use something closer to 72 decatherms.
Okay.
Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. Now, back on slide 9, you said that even under your proposal, 60% of a residential bill is variable. And by saying that, I assume you were referring to the cost of gas, the commodity cost of the gas. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. And so is 60% the percentage, is that based on the 91 decatherm mean customer?
That is correct. So if you look at, again, I don't know, I have this as slide 8 in my slide deck, but to get to the approximately, I think it comes out to 59%, that approximate number, you just simply take the $365 shown for the cost of gas into the $622 total.
Yeah, just using your numbers here, I got 58.7%, but that's, I guess, we're in the ballpark, right?
Approximately 60%, yes.
So what's the percentage of the bill that's variable for a typical customer or a median customer using 72 decatherms a year?
I don't have a calculator in front of me.
Well, here.
It would be slightly less.
Let me tell you, I did it and then ask you if you think that's correct. I looked at the 5 decatherms for the month of May and what is there for the cost of gas, and I took that and just assumed, multiplied the 5 times 12, got 60 decatherms, and multiplied that times the $4, 0.011, and got, I came up with about $365 a year. Does that sound right?
I don't know where you're getting 60 decatherms. You just spoke to 72 for a median customer. So
if we added one more decatherm to 5, we had 6. We took the calculations for the month of May and we added one more, made it 6 times 12. That would be 72. Does that sound right? Could we get to it that way?
Okay.
So based on my calculations, a typical residential customer would really only control 52% of their bill, or 52.45%.
Without a calculator up here,
does that sound about right?
Reasonable.
So it's not. So for the typical customer, it's not quite as high as 60% that a customer controls.
For a 72 decatherm per year customer, it's not as high as a 91 decatherm per year. I don't know if you can call either of them typical necessarily. Everybody falls into a different consumption level.
Okay. And if we look at the effect of your proposal on an even lower use residential customer, say that uses 48 decatherms a year, would you agree that that would mean that lower use customer would only control maybe 42% of their bill?
I would agree. As the annual consumption decreases, the portion of the bill that will be fixed will also, or will be volumetric, will also decrease. But I would add that somebody that uses 48 decatherms in a year has a much lower bill than somebody that uses 91 decatherms in a year.
And I would agree with your statement that if you use more, you pay more. But isn't it true that the greater portion of the bill that is fixed, the less control that a customer has, and the less savings that they would have for using less? Would you
assume? I would agree.
Okay. And back to the cost of service study that you were a part of with regards to the rate design within the residential class. Would you acknowledge that study showed that only 75% of the residential costs are customer-based?
75% sounds correct in terms of costs that were customer-related, with the remaining, with the exception of probably less than 1% being demand-related. Less than 1% energy-related, the remaining 24-something being demand-related. The point is that the demand-related costs are still fixed in nature, just as the customer-related costs are.
Well, that's a difference of opinion between you and other witnesses in the case, correct?
Yes.
But so your opinion is that demand costs are fixed and do not vary between customers.
Well, I'd like to step back one second. I don't feel it's an opinion of mine. The costs are fixed. Those demand-related costs are largely the portion of the mains, the investment in the distribution mains that are in the ground. As Mr. Rubin said, those are sunk costs, fixed costs, whatever you'd like to say. They don't vary with residential consumption. They are fixed costs.
But Mr. Hartensbueller, won't the size of the pipe that's needed to be sunk differ based on the demand?
I'd argue no. If we have a new subdivision going in, each home's going to be served with the same service. It's not going to matter whether one of them chooses to just have a fire pit or one of them chooses to heat a three-stall garage to 80 degrees in January.
But you're including in your cost charged to the residential class pipes that are further up the distribution chain. Those are going to be bigger or smaller depending on the demand and usage, correct?
The cost, the investment in the mains is driven by demand, yes. I don't think you can categorically say that there's enough spread between the demand. There's not enough difference between the residential class's customers to justify building a rate design around those specific high-use customers that may drive the demand higher, in your opinion.
Have you performed any analysis to prove that, what that variation is?
No, I do not have an analysis for that.
But you do acknowledge there's also an energy component to the residential costs, delivery of costs, as well as the demand and customer costs, correct?
3 cents.
And so is your proposal here to apply all of this rate increase into another fixed increase for customers? Is that just based on taking your cost study and just rounding it up to 100%?
It's based on my belief that the costs being recovered are fixed in nature, and in the absence of having demand meters where we'd have the ability to charge a demand rate to residential customers for those demand-related costs, you have to choose another way of collecting those dollars. And I believe it is a much more appropriate manner to do that through the fixed charge, because they're fixed costs in nature, than it is to collect those through a volumetric charge that we currently don't have in place today. It would be taking a step backwards to revert back to adding a volumetric charge that we just went away from less than 3 years ago. Our system did not change in the last 3 years, and the composition of the residential class didn't change in the last 3 years. To make the decision to go to straight fixed variable pricing imprudent at this time compared to 2015?
Well, there are there are differences of opinion about whether MDU has a straight fixed variable rate design. You acknowledge that there's different definitions about what that term means.
Mr. Rubin said he didn't agree that it was straight fixed variable, but
tell me, what is the point of doing a cost of service study if you aren't going to recognize and classifying costs in these three different buckets if you're not going to acknowledge that in the rate design?
It is acknowledged in the rate design because what the cost of service study indicates is that the costs being recovered are fixed in nature, and then it's a choice of a matter of decision-making on how you're going to recover them.
So you believe even the energy portion of rates is fixed for residential customers?
I believe the energy portion of rates is de minimis at 3 cents. I think it would be quite inappropriate to add a charge to recover that.
So what is the point of analyzing the cost to serve the residential class? If
the embedded class cost service study doesn't just guide rate design, it also guided the revenue allocation or the increase, the allocation of the increase. So
in your opinion, is the class cost of service study only for the purpose of class allocation, or is it also used to guide rate design within each class?
As I stated before, it's used as a guide for both. Mm-hmm. Well, it gives you the answer for the return by class, and then it serves as a guide for the rate design.
And there's many important factors that the commission should take into account other than the cost of service study when setting rates, correct?
Correct.
And is one of those factors that the commission should consider whether or not the rates encourage conservation?
That is for the commission to decide. I would argue that our current rates do allow for conservation to continue occurring. In our last case, for instance, which was just under 3 years ago, the average residential use annually was 94 decatherms. Today it's 91, and in that whole interim period, we've had the straight fixed variable or fixed charge rate. So conservation or efficiency has still happened in those last 3 years. So I would argue that this rate design has not done anything to impede conservation or efficiency efforts on behalf of our customers.
But you do acknowledge that the greater the fixed part of the bill is, the less the incentive is for energy efficiency and conservation?
Yes.
It's just not, there's some incentive, it's just not as great as it could have been. Could be, right?
Correct. If it was 100% volumetric, of course, there's going to be more benefit to conservation.
How would you rank the importance of the different principles of rate design when setting residential rates, with the cost of service being one and the various other factors?
I think it's a balance that you take a look, and you want to have gradualism, which I think gets back to the one of the key benefits of our SSIP. That would be primary benefit in terms of rate structure there. You want equitable rates. I think there's no more equitable rate for residential rate class than the current rate structure that we have, because the cost to serve each of these customers is essentially the same, with the exception of a handful of outliers. So charging them each the same because it costs the same to serve them is equitable. It's efficient for the company to return or collect our revenues. It's not dependent on outside forces such as weather. So I think it's a balance of various principles.
Is public acceptance an important rate design factor that should be considered by the commission?
Yes.
Are you familiar with other similar utilities and the rate designs that have been approved for the residential class? Do you?
Yes. Well, generally.
And would it be fair to say that most LDCs, local natural gas delivery companies, have some component in the delivery cost that's fixed as well as a component that is variable?
Yes, I believe a different LDC here in North Dakota has straight fixed variable pricing just like us, though.
But if you looked at LDCs in the country or even in the region, wouldn't this utility be on the far extreme in applying 100% of the delivery cost into a fixed fee?
I can't speak to it because I don't know the rate designs at other utilities, but if we are, I would say we're not at the far extreme. I'd say we're at the forefront of rate design evolution in that this is what makes sense, and this is where this commission in North Dakota went 3 years ago prudently.
And so so when you say moving forward or being on the forefront, you're talking about moving away from the cost of service towards just an absolute fixed fee.
I'd say moving towards cost of service, with the exception of we don't have demand meters, so a perfectly fair, perfect world for would be there'd be demand meters, and we would have the fixed charge covering the customer charge indicated by the class cost of service study, and then a demand charge for the demand component. In the absence of a demand meter for each of our residential customers, which we do not have, you have to choose how are you going to collect that component of costs. And I believe, as I've said, that it makes more sense to collect them through the fixed charge than to initiate a volumetric charge.
Are you aware of utilities that have implemented demand meters, and have you had the opportunity to review the data that has been collected?
I'm not aware of specifics, and I haven't reviewed data, no.
Okay. Would you be surprised if those utilities found a great deal of variability in demand amongst residential customers?
I can't speak to the results that they've found.
I understand. That's all I have. Thank you.
Hey, Major Onsaker.
No, sir.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
No questions.
Okay, commissioners. Commissioner Crocius.
Well, good afternoon, Jordan.
Good afternoon.
The energy conservation, energy efficiencies and conservation approach where residential homeowners can control their utility bill, their gas bill, to some extent. Do you think that comes at the price of comfort for some that can't afford to put new windows in, can't upgrade the thermostat, the furnace, et cetera? Yeah, they're really strapped, and where do they go?
I think the people that are in a position such as that are truly that strapped, likely qualify for the LEAP assistance program, and they're not going to be paying, if they qualify and take advantage of that program, they're not going to be paying the full boat. So I can't speak specifically. I haven't had to make a decision for myself where I sacrifice comfort to save on my utility bill, but I hope it's not something that's commonly occurring.
Do you know what percentage of MDU's customers receive assistance?
Not off the top of my head, but I know we could get that very quickly for you.
Do you think it would cover the majority, if not all, of the most extreme cases?
I would like to believe that the program was built in a way that it was intended to cover those that truly needed the assistance, so I would say yes.
Do you ever see a scenario where residential would be broken from, not just residential, whether it's the biggest home in Bismarck or if it's the tiniest home, and assuming income would be proportionate? Do you think there's an argument to be made ever to have a different type of residential classification or a breakdown within that group or
bifurcated residential class, I guess, it's based on demographic type information of income and age and so forth. We don't have I don't think it would be feasible, as we don't have the information on our on a customer by customer basis of their income and, you know, the characteristics of their home. I can just speak from personal relations of mine. I know of, you know, a young mother of one over in Mandan that uses much more than average energy, and living in a very inefficient trailer in Mandan. And then I also know of people that have a second home that use the cabin on, you know, 6-7 weekends. So what the ARP is proposing is a volumetric charge that would hurt single mother of one and subsidize second homeowner doesn't use it much. So I believe the rate structure we have in place is most equitable, and I don't know that there'd be a way to split the class based on income or other demographic factors.
Be challenging.
Yes.
Okay, no other questions for me.
Chairman Christman.
As I've thought throughout this case, and actually before too, in the case a few years ago, sometimes I'm confused too by how to properly evaluate the mean average versus the median average in a fairly simple way, and I'm not saying it has to be a certain particular guideline, but can you provide us something that breaks down the amount of usage into more than just the two extremes and what one of those two or each of those two averages are? And for example, here's what I'm thinking of. Like, what percentage of your customers use 40 to 60, 60 to 80, 80 to 100, and 100 to 120, and then whatever's on the ends of that? Or something similar if you have something already done.
I could either, I don't have it available here, we could create something like that. Mr. Rubin actually did that in his direct testimony. It's, I think, Scott J. Rubin 7, I believe is his, if you'd like to take a quick look, to save us the time of...
What? This is on his direct testimony?
It's Exhibit SJR 7.
Okay, I'm looking at it now, and
so you'll want to look at the all customers would be the.
So what does that mean in the low 10%?
So down below the number of accounts in the sample is roughly 76,000, and we provide the reason I'm pointing to this is we provided the data and I confirmed its okay. its accuracy, but. It's 76,000 instead of 96,000 because when you scrub the file, which has over a million rows, there are customers that have, you know, only 2 months or 3 months of bills, and then there's other customers due to billing adjustments or whatever happens that have maybe 14 or 15 months. So I believe what he did here is scrubbed the data for customer or accounts that have between 9 and 13, I want to say, 9 and 13 or 9 and 14 months or bills. So it's a more accurate representation of the whole data set. So when the 10%, like the 10% decile, he's got the consumption, 39.16. You can do the quick math of each of those deciles has 7,600 customers. So there's 7,600 customers that use approximately 40 or less decatherms in a year. And then the next bucket has another 7,600 customers.
Okay. Well, you finish on your second time around. Maybe I'll think of some other questions on that. But I'm sorry I missed that before. appreciate you pointing it out. And then that takes care of my request, I believe.
Commissioner Fedorchuk.
But no, I have some other questions.
I'm sorry.
You had provided some examples, like where you are back up to ground source.
Yes.
Heat or cabins or things like that of what might be some of those extraordinarily low usage customers, which doesn't necessarily mean that it is being paid by a one or two person household, nor that they're low income. It just means that it's an occasional use thing, correct?
That is absolutely correct.
And then let's talk about the extraordinarily high volume usages. In previous question of Mr. Rubin, I kind of speculated that could those possibly be farms or other small businesses? Is that something that occurs out there, or do those not fall into residential classes?
I can confirm it should not be small businesses. I believe we do an annual or probably more often scrub to make sure customers are in the correct customer class or served under the right rate. But I do, when I evaluate this data, the ones that seem really high, I do pull them up on our customer service and billing software just to see, is this really, are there homes out there that use this much gas? And the handful that I looked at really were, it is possible for a home in Bismarck Mandan to use 250, 300 decatherms in a year. Some people have heated outdoor pools and that sort of thing. But it won't be grain dryers. I believe you mentioned or asked if it was potentially that. Those are served under the small interruptible, a separate rate. So it might be farmhouses, but it won't be the grain dryers specifically.
Okay, thanks for clarifying that for me. I feel like this is a big part of the whole case is being mischaracterized here a little bit, and maybe it's just me that's feeling that way. I'm on your very first slide, I believe, the Tax Cuts and Job Act impact.
Okay.
Is there any disagreement with the company that the 2.287 or almost $2.288 million is the actual net impact of that for the company?
I'm aware of no disagreement that was the benefit of the tax reform.
Okay, and is there disagreement that should be returned to the consumers?
Not from the company's standpoint.
So when we talk about this as a proposed increase, the $3.575 million, that's the proposed increase for the consumers. But if we were to deny that and say everything just stays the same, the company is actually getting almost a $3 million increase, correct? Because you're then not giving that money back to them.
No, you would have to take into consideration that we are not earning our authorized rate of return at the moment. So there's not money to refund. If what this was saying is that pre-tax reform, we needed a $5.9 million increase to get up to our authorized rate of return or our requested rate of return in this case. So as a result of the reform, $2.3 million was trimmed off of that because of the effect of the tax rate had and on the edits in the case itself. So if you were to go into a hypothetical situation where at the time of filing we were earning exactly as authorized as requested or authorized in this case, and then tax reform happened, then we would have been in a position where it would have been right or needed to refund $2.3 million to the customer. But as it stands today, we haven't earned in excess because we're not earning our authorized return right now.
If your authorized return isn't a guaranteed return.
I agree. It's allowed.
And so if we were, if there had been no tax reform and we just denied everything in this case, you would continue on making about the rate that you've been making in recent, until you, the interim rates were adopted, correct?
Well, we would continue under return, earning less than authorized.
And so if now nothing changed except for the tax cuts, that gives you almost $3 million more toward earning your rate of return, correct?
And it gets you closer. You're going to earn a higher rate of return. And that I guess I could point to my embedded study as filed. It showed that we were returning. I'll have to look at it.
Maybe let me ask you a different way. In order to get to the rate of return that you would like, you still need $5.8 million more dollars, but we only need to raise rates $3.6 million dollars because you're going to use the 2.3 that should go back to the taxpayers, but you just
It's now baked into reducing an increase instead of,
right?
Yes.
So I don't remember whose testimony it was yesterday. Travis's reconciliation chart that totals up to the difference. Well, I guess that's not between zero. That's the difference between staff and the company. But the bottom line, you're asking still to get to the 5.6 by increase in rates and a little less than half by using that tax refund. Or not refund, but tax reduction.
Yes, the tax reform had the effect of helping us offset the needed dollar increase. So I mean customers really are, it's actual dollars that the tax reform is saving them by requiring less of an increase, right?
And so it's actually the consumers are not getting that tax refund back necessarily. It's staying with the company, but it is offsetting a potential increase that would have otherwise been requested.
I think I'd have to defer to a different company witness to further the discussion, because I don't think I'm okay. Quite following.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, now, Commissioner Fedorchak.
Okay, well, Randy has me thoroughly confused. So, on the taxes, so I viewed it, since we're talking about that, and I need to just at least explore this with you, and if somebody else needs to come up and straighten out. But I viewed the taxes as, so on your revenue deficiency, if you were going to need this much revenue, you included in that what the tax rate would be on those revenues. So with a lower tax rate, you just need to collect less. So you're not collecting that from the customers. So why would we, and that's why we reduced their interim rates, because we're not collecting that now either, just collecting less tax.
I'd like to defer to,
okay.
I mean, Travis is likely our best,
alrighty.
Best
sounds
witness
good.
If we can get him.
Then, Randy, you made me forget my question. Hold on. Oh, so back to median user, the 72 decatherm per year. And maybe this is in here, maybe you guys have already talked about it, and I just didn't catch it. But so if you were to take the $1.82 average customer increase per month, correct?
Correct.
Is that based on the 91 decatherm customer? If you were to take the 72 decatherm customer,
okay,
and apply a let's see, how do I want to state this? Calculate it the way the AARP is proposing.
Yes.
What would the difference of their bill be? Have we seen that?
I can tell you.
Okay.
Okay. So if you were
average increase, I should say.
If you were to propose a volumetric charge for the full increase in play and have no change to the fixed charge, that's what you're getting at, correct?
Yep.
So that volumetric charge would be 24 cents a decatherm. And I can quickly walk through how that. So on this slide here, what you'd do, does this have a pointer?
Yep.
It's just this number divided by the decatherms for the residential class is the way it would work out. So it would be $0.239.
Right?
23.9 cents.
23.9 cents per decatherm.
Correct. So then
that would be your volumetric charge.
Yep. So you'd simply take that times 72 decatherms. And I don't have a calculator, but.
Here, I'll give it to you. You can use mine. Is that allowed, Judge? Oh, there you go.
So it's going to be the difference.
It sometimes gets a little tricky putting calculators in front of witnesses, but.
I'm an accountant.
Yeah.
So that's going to get you a $17.21 increase for the year. And what you're going to compare that to is the $21 and. Is it 74 cents? $21.78 that occurs under existing rate design.
So if I did my math right on my iPhone, it's $1.43 per month increase versus what you guys have calculated as $1.82. So.
Yep.
Okay. So, $4.57 total, $4.57 per year difference, if you did it that way for the
correct
bulk of the customers, is what we'd be looking at.
Correct. And again, we can't categorically say who those 72 decatherm or 60 decatherm customers are. They could be me, or I know my grandpa used 80 in 2017, and he lives in a 950 square foot house by himself in Mandan. So I can't say who's using what.
Well, I have to believe that since the AARP has used that 72 decatherm and is bringing that forward, that they believe that represents who they're representing more fairly than the 91.
It seems so.
That's the conclusion I'm making from that. That fact that they're using that. So, okay, that is helpful. Thank you. That's all my questions.
Okay, back to you, Mr. Sanderson.
Thank you, Jordan. I don't want to get too far down this, but just with respect to the tax, you're aware your understanding is the company's tax rate went from 35% to 21% as a result of the recent Tax Act.
That's correct.
Okay. And that means the company is going to pay less in taxes as an expense, and those savings are passed on through to the customers.
That is correct.
Okay. I have nothing further. Thank you.
Mr. Armstrong?
No questions.
Mr. Kaufman?
No questions.
Major Ansicker?
No questions.
Okay. Well,
no questions.
Okay. All right. Thank you. You can step down.
Thank you.
Let's go with your next witness.
Thank you, Judge. Montana Dakota would call Stephanie Bosch.
Did we move that exhibit? Yeah, we did. Okay. Ms. Bosch, please spell your first and last name for the record.
S-T-E-P-H-A-N-I-E-B-O-S-C-H.
Okay, raise your right hand. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Thank you.
Judge, before we begin, just for the record, I have that all MDU exhibits 1 through 16 have now, 1 through 15 have been admitted. Is that?
Yes.
Okay. And 16 is Mrs. Bosch's PowerPoint slides.
Yep, that's
okay. Yep. Good afternoon, Ms. Bosch. Could you please state your full name and business address?
Stephanie Bosch, 400 North 4th Street, Bismarck, North Dakota.
And whom are you employed by?
Montana Dakota Utilities.
And what is your position with the company?
I'm a manager in the Regulatory Affairs Department.
And could you briefly describe your responsibilities with the company in that role?
Sure. My primary responsibilities include the proper application of the company's gas and electric rates in the company's billing system, as well as other tariffs.
Could you provide the commission with just a general overview of your educational background and work experience?
Sure. I have a Bachelor of Business and Public Administration from the University of North Dakota.
And have you testified in other proceedings before state regulatory bodies?
I have.
And you're familiar with Montana Dakota's application in the present case?
I am.
And could you describe your involvement in this case with the application?
I was responsible for the development of the revenues as well as the tariffs.
In addition, did you submit pre-filed testimony in this proceeding?
I did.
And if asked the same questions as your pre-filed, would your answers remain the same?
They would.
Okay. And you've also prepared a PowerPoint presentation, or PowerPoint to go along with your testimony today?
I have.
Okay. I want to start with the SSIP, the System Safety and Integrity Program. Can you explain the new rate structure as designated as Rate 94?
Sure. Consistent with the company's other electric riders, the company has outlined on the tariff the applicability, the development of the revenue requirement, and the rate within the context of a tariff.
Can you explain how the SSIP cost will be allocated to the customer classes?
Sure. The allocation of costs in the rider will maintain the rate design and allocation within the rider of that approved in this case.
In addition, your testimony covers Rate 74, the proposed firm general contracted demand service rate. Could you just describe that tariff?
Sure. It's a new tariff that would be available to non-residential customers for customers who currently have a natural gas standby generator or customers who qualify under the interruptible service tariff but want to take firm service.
And as part of your pre-filed testimony, you had identified a number of additional changes the company is proposing to modify its natural gas tariffs and other rates. Could you briefly outline those changes that are being proposed in this case?
Sure. Many of the changes that are proposed within the tariffs are not new change or not a new practice or policy, but rather we're including them now as a point of reference for both the company and the customer. A couple that I want to call out that are changes are we are requesting to revise the non-residential seasonal reconnection charge to reduce the seasonal reconnection charge to reflect a customer's distribution revenues collected while in service if the customer's use while in service is greater than the class average. We're requesting a minimum of a $30 charge in the event of unauthorized use of service, as well as to increase the return check charge.
And Ms. Bosch, finally, the company has proposed to increase the return check charge, and you're aware advocacy staff and AARP opposes that. Can you explain the rationale for the company's proposed increase in the return check charge?
The company requested an increase in the return check charges. That is the level that was recently authorized in the company's North Dakota electric operations implemented last August.
Okay. With that, I have no further questions. Your Honor, we would offer MDU Exhibit 16 at this time.
Sir Armstrong?
No objection.
Mr. Kaufman? Any objection to number 16?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Cat, Major Unsecura.
No objection.
Ms. Jeff Kotsako.
No objection.
Okay, MDU 16 is received. Hey, Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you. Ms. Bosch, attached to your direct testimony is the proposed SSIP tariff, correct?
Correct.
And that's a rate 94 tariff.
Correct.
You would agree with me there's no, I don't know, maybe it won't be on tariff, but there's no expiration date for it. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And you have you been sitting in the hearing room today and yesterday?
I have.
And you've heard a lot of talk about early vintage steel pipe and early vintage plastic pipe.
Yes.
Is that referenced anywhere in the tariff?
No.
So the tariff's broader than EVSP and EVPP?
I would say it doesn't include anything specific to the type of pipe being replaced. That's correct.
In fact, it says it's a tariff for anything that is safety-related. Is that fair?
I would say, yes, that's
correct. Couldn't any pipeline replacement be argued to be safety-related?
Yes.
So this could involve every single one of the company's replacement projects.
I think it was proposed with respect to the safety program that Mr. Darris talked about.
When this was proposed, and I still am trying to understand that a little bit, so if you don't know, just please let me know. But this was proposed in your direct testimony in July, correct?
Correct.
And then we talked about the program and the study with Mr. Darris yesterday, but the document attached to his testimony wasn't prepared until January of 2018.
That's what he said, yes.
Okay. How can you have the tariff prepared before the program or the study?
The tariff was proposed to recover the specific projects that the company had intended to.
Which projects are those?
I don't have an answer for that.
And I know in your rebuttal testimony you agreed to some language changes.
Right, you know, yes.
If this is adopted, you agreed to some suggested language changes. So
yes.
It just hasn't been rewritten or anything yet, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And you said the company is still seeking a $40 return on return check fee. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. And you agree with me that's not cost-based?
I agree.
Okay. That's all the questions I have. Thank you.
Mr. Kaufman.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon, Ms. Bosch. do you think that the cost of service study is important in setting various, you know, miscellaneous fees and such?
The cost of service study?
Yes.
For miscellaneous fees?
Yes.
I think it's a guide for rates, the tariff rates.
Mm-hmm. But not the fees?
I would not agree with that, no.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. So you think the cost of service study should have no impact on things such as late payment fees or return check fees?
I think it's a guide for the setting of rates, not late payment charges or return check charges, no.
You don't consider those to be rates?
I guess I distinguish between rates such as those used to serve customers versus different types of charges such as late payment charges or return check charges.
So what if the and what is the cost to the company when a check is returned?
It was on Mr. Rubin's presentation this morning. It's $3.
$2.90, something like that.
Something like that, yes, okay. Under $3, yes.
I know people like to round up. So you believe that these that this fee should, I guess, serve a social purpose to deter people from writing a bad check to the utility company?
I think it. I proposed it at such a level that it would deter, I believe.
And how do you know that it would be a deterrent? Have you done any behavioral studies or read any behavioral studies about the sensitivity level to?
I have not done any specific studies. I think when you look at our return check charges, they continue to increase each year. I also...
If I may ask a clarifying question there, when you say return, are you talking about bank return charge fees or are you talking about utility?
It's the return check charges on mm-hmm. that we have.
And when you say that they continue to go up, are you referring to North Dakota or are you referring, you're not referring nationally?
No.
Okay. So how did you pick that number of $40?
It was consistent with that approved for North Dakota Electric.
Do you know why that number was picked for North Dakota Electric?
It was consistent with that approved in our South Dakota operation.
And do you know how that number got picked by South Dakota?
It is the maximum allowed under the law in South Dakota.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Is there any other basis for that number other than it's the maximum allowed by South Dakota law?
No. It was consistent, and that's why I proposed it here as well.
Do you know anyone that's accidentally bounced a check?
I have.
Have you done it? I've done it.
I personally
I've done it.
Yes.
And what were the circumstances? Did you intentionally write a bad check?
Objection, relevance, Judge.
Yeah, sustained. I think we get the point.
Would you agree with me that most often when someone bounces a check, it's because they get paid on Friday, their bill's due Wednesday, and they think there'll be enough time to make that. And they don't realize that the bank holds on to the money for a while, puts a hold on that.
I don't agree with you.
Why do you think that someone might write a bad check?
I think there are a number of reasons why someone could write a bad check. Your example being one of them, yes, I believe. There may be a misunderstanding of float time for checks. But there are other reasons, I believe, for customers writing a bad check.
What are some other reasons?
There could be such things such as they changed to an ACH and they didn't realize it's a quicker turnaround than the check is in the mail. I do believe there are customers who it buys them a couple more days of service, so they realize that and will write the check.
And what are the bank fees for a return check in this region?
They vary. I don't know the range. I would speculate at the range.
What would you speculate? That is.
Objection calls for speculation.
Okay. Withdrawn.
Yeah, unless you can lay a foundation.
Okay. In your opinion, the fees charged by banks for bouncing a check are not sufficient deterrent?
I don't believe so.
Okay. Isn't it true that over the last few years, the amount of uncollectibles has actually been decreasing for the utility company?
I believe that's testimony I heard yesterday, yes.
And that's without any punitive fees to encourage more prompt payment, correct?
We have a return check charge in place today.
Of $15?
Yes. Correct.
But you still don't think that that's sufficient to deter behavior?
I think we continue to see return check charges increase, and so
you're just following the pack. This recommendation is not based on any quantification, other than what I guess South Dakota or other utilities in North Dakota have done.
Right. I did not do any studies to.
Okay.
For the $40.
And if this fee is increased to $40, how will a customer know about that fee?
We do in bill inserts, as well as on the back of the bill, it does disclose that there is a return check charge. It doesn't disclose the amount, but it does state on the back of the bill that there is such a charge. We also do annual inserts that not only talk about the rates, but also do include things such as return check charge.
So can you explain to me how it would serve as a deterrent to increase this fee from $15 to $40 if customers don't know?
I would say customers have the are aware through the bill inserts.
And how often is that put in their bills?
The back of the bill is there every month, and the insert is annual.
But didn't you just say that it doesn't claim the amount?
No, it does not.
Well, if that part of the bill isn't going to change when this increases?
No.
If it increases to $40. Well, then how is the increase from $15 to $40 going to serve as a deterrent if the customer doesn't know?
The customer will be notified with their first bill.
And what will that note? What form will that notice take?
It will be a bill insert in the customer's bill.
Okay. And so that'll be a one-time. So, like the month after rates go into effect, they'll receive an insert that says the fee's gone up to $40. Is that how it works?
No, inserts are not included on rates every month. Okay. It's an annual insert after that.
Okay. So it'll be an annual notification. But it's to your belief that the customers will look at that, and at least some customers will say, well, I guess I'm not going to write a bad check because the fee has gone up even more?
Objection calls for speculation.
Well, I'm just trying to get to what the real basis for this number is. There has to be some rationale.
Expecting or when they get a bill, she has no idea.
Yeah,
speculation.
Sustained.
All right. That's all I have. Thank you.
Okay, Major. Ms. Jeffcoat Sackle.
Well, I just wanted to follow up. You had we're talking speculation here about charges going up, but twice you said to Mr. Kaufman that return check charges continue to go up, that you're seeing them go up. Now, was that a misstatement of charges, or what charges are you seeing that are going up?
There's a work paper that shows all the different types of miscellaneous revenue, and it has the 3 years, 2014, 15, and 16. And when you look at that work paper, it shows those dollars in total for North Dakota Gas are going up.
Okay, so charges.
It's the total collected
the total
under
revenue
yes.
is going up for return checks.
Correct.
Okay, thank you. That's all I have.
Okay, commissioners. Commissioner Crocious.
How many NSFs? I'll get this out yet. Do you deal with a year?
I don't have that number readily in front of me.
Would you say it's consistent with, I shouldn't say necessarily industry average, but just what any other business might experience? I'm just trying to decide how significant of an issue is this for you.
I would only be speculating on that.
Okay,
I
get that information?
The number of NSFs? Yes. Do you have a specific?
As a percentage of total number of bills that went out and to see the math, the total number of bills that actually were sent. And I'm assuming that also if someone doesn't have sufficient funds and they're on automatic payment, that also is considered non-sufficient funds as well.
Correct.
Yeah, okay. Okay, and then on the going to the SIP language and council covered it, but I just want to be clear again. The language is very broad, as was stated, and it says costs to be recovered under the system safety and integrity program. Adjustment mechanism may include operation and maintenance expenditures, depreciation, taxes. And a current return, et cetera, on project cost during construction. So was the intent that that the specifics have been laid out in terms of if it were approved, this is where the money would go this time, and then having to come before the commission for pre-approval on future projects, that it would be controlled that way? Because it is rather open-ended.
The tariff was, I guess, can you repeat your question?
Well, the language is very broad. I'm just wondering, to counsel's point, how do we really know where the money will go?
I think, as mentioned by previous company witnesses, we had talked about filing in March a plan that would specify the types of projects that would be included in that coming year.
Okay, so projects moving forward
right.
would be
correct.
Put in front. Okay. And then how would you explain this to customers?
The SSIP?
Right, right, without causing alarm.
I would say we're taking a proactive approach. The system is safe, as our witnesses have testified to, but that it is a proactive approach so to prevent any future issues going forward.
Do you expect that would be challenging for customers to understand that it's not a problem, but we have to move quicker on it, which
I don't think it is. I think customers understand safety and they realize the importance of it. And so I don't think it would be a call for alarm.
Okay, thank you. No other questions. And I told you two, and I think that was three.
Chairman Cressman.
You are a manager of regulatory affairs for both electric and gas, correct?
Correct.
And do you see a higher percentage of bills coming back with NSF checks in communities where you have both electric and gas service and presumably a higher bill than in the area for the customers who only have electric service?
I don't have that information, and I would only be speculating if it's skewed one way or the other versus based on the community served.
Okay.
I don't know.
No other questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Thanks, Stephanie. So on the increased fee to $40 for NSF checks, has the increase on the electric side resulted in a decrease in the number of NSF checks? Has it had the effect of being a deterrent, I guess?
I haven't pulled any recent data. When I last looked at it, it was maybe through September, so I think that was too new to be able to determine if that was.
Okay. Since you're providing some follow-up to Commissioner Crosius, maybe you could add that,
okay.
those numbers, too, since the increase on the electric side, what has been the effect, so we can get a sense of whether you're goal in raising it is working or not.
Okay, we can do that. Thanks.
Commissioner, just for clarification on that, do you want some period before?
Sure.
And I mean, maybe on both those, and just the parameters you're looking for us so we can make sure we fully answer.
I guess I don't know what would be a fair number of years for before, maybe a trend from the previous couple of years prior to increasing it to $40, and then as much data as you can since you've implemented the increase.
Thank you.
My question is, can we possibly get that by tomorrow, like the other one?
We certainly are going to have some additional information that's been requested tomorrow, and we will do everything we can to get that information along with the other information that's been requested in this hearing by tomorrow.
Okay. Sorry to interrupt.
Now, back to the tariff. I'm looking at the tariff language for the SSIP, and it looks like it's pretty comparable to other rider language, where you say you'll come to us with a list of here's how I'm understanding it. You'll come to us with a list of projects in March. You'll go about your business doing those things. We'll evaluate those, and we'll say, come to a decision on, yeah, those look prudent or not, throw out the ones that we don't like or think are imprudent, come up with a final amount, and then anything that isn't covered, Nicole yesterday said, would probably be brought forward in a rate case. You will also, in your filing, go back and look at what you proposed the year before and collected and trued up based on actual expenses. So there might be an overcharge that's taken off any future charge. Is that how
that's correct?
This is generally
yes.
going to work. And the projects will be outlined. I guess that's where the vagueness really comes in terms of how much detail we're going to get on those projects and the need and all of that. You also said you wouldn't object to a filing fee being required as part of this tariff.
That's correct. We would not object to
a filing fee. Anything else you want to add to changes that the company's considering or might bring forward as a result of discussions so far?
I think I would add that the company is willing to work with the commission to address any concerns that they may have with the current tariff as written. If you have mentioned vagueness, so if there's something we can include in here that clarifies, we typically don't like to get as specific as maybe the type of pipe, because as Mr. Darris mentioned, there's things that change. They're focused on these, but if something else, and I would only say speculating, something else comes out that warrants looking at, we don't want to get too specific in a tariff necessarily.
We would have an opportunity during our discussion with you to evaluate the types.
Yes.
And say, we don't think this belongs in here. It's not a safety
right.
It would, related improvement.
It would follow the same of our any of our other riders.
Do you typically include, is it typically something that you'd include in a tariff to have like an end date?
We haven't typically included end dates for things other than maybe a pilot kind of a program.
Okay. And then the infrastructure surcharges that were discussed by Mr. Rubin, I believe. That's not a language we've used. Is it the same thing as this? Is this basically a surcharge, or is that some other type of design and mechanism, tool?
I think you can use surcharge, rider, tracker interchangeably.
Yep. Okay, just wanted to confirm that I wasn't missing something there. And how about including in this that after a certain amount of dollars spent, everything above needs to come into for a general rate case? Is that something that would be spelled out in the tariff?
I would repeat my earlier suggestion or comment that the company is willing to work with the commission to address their concerns.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Yep. No more questions.
Chairman Christman has another question.
A couple of them, Your Honor. I'm pretty tired of this NSF thing, too, but this seemed too obvious to not ask, and I didn't think of it until Commissioner Fedorchak was talking. So in a town like Hazen where there's no natural gas service, an NSF check would be charged a $40 fee because it's electric, correct?
Correct.
And in a town like Jamestown where someone else provides electricity, an NSF check currently would be charged $15.
Correct.
So what's a NSF fee for a bad check in Bismarck for a customer that has both?
They would be assessed a return check charge for both.
So one check bounces, and they'd get a check then for $55?
Correct.
Huh, okay. I'll be real cautious.
Move back to Hazen.
And if there's just not enough to go around, I guess I'll make sure and bounce the one from Hazen.
Mr. Sanderson, redirect.
Thank you. Just briefly, Mrs. Bosch, Rate 94 is entitled a System Safety and Integrity Program Adjustment Mechanism.
Correct.
And it certainly, as proposed, was only to address the SSIP programs that have been identified in the company's SSIP program.
Correct.
Now, you were asked a question by counsel. Mr. Darris was when he introduced, and in his rebuttal, he was talking about the March revision to the SSIP program. Do you recall that?
I do.
With the original filing in this case, Mr. Darris originally filed an SSIP program to go along with this tariff. You're aware of that?
Yes.
And it was a part of his exhibits, but then what we've been talking about was the revised in March of 18.
Correct.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that. One of the things you indicated, Mrs. Bosch, is that you'd certainly, the company has always been and will continue to be willing to work with the commission to develop a rate and tariff system that they think is appropriate for this. That was your testimony?
Yes.
Now, in your rebuttal testimony, you also indicated in response to concerns that advocacy staff and AARP pointed out with some issues that the company was open to revising the tariff to address some of the concerns they have.
Correct.
And in addition, is the company today still willing to work not only with the commission, but with staff and AARP to try to revise this to a tariff that promotes the idea of customer safety in North Dakota for the natural gas pipeline replacement and improvement?
Yes.
I have no further questions. Thank you.
Mr. Armstrong.
Nothing that's not obvious. No questions.
Mr. Kaufman.
No questions.
Major.
No questions.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
No questions.
Okay, let's take about a 10-minute break here, come back about 2:40.
But Judge, before we go, and maybe to help this, at this time, just for the record, Montana Dakota has presented their witnesses and is resting their case in chief.
Okay. All right. You got that on the record?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, off the record. Okay. All right. We'll go back on the record here. About 2:40 something. Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Oh my gosh, you're way ahead.
Mr. Pavlovic, please spell your first and last name for the record.
First name Carl, K-A-R-L. Last name Pavlovic, P-A-V-L-O-V-I-C.
Okay. Raise your right hand, please. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I do.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you. Are you the same Carl Pavlovic who submitted direct and surrebuttal testimony in this case marked as Exhibits PSC 20 and 21?
Yes, I am.
Prior to the hearing, have you reviewed your testimony?
Yes.
And if I were to ask you the same questions today, would you provide the same answers?
Yes.
Do you have any further explanations you wish to make regarding your testimony?
Yes, I do, in light of the continuing discussion about what exactly are the 2018 SSIP projects. In its original filing, MDU listed 6 SSIP projects for 2018. There were 3 low-pressure system replacement projects in New Salem, Taylor, and Bismarck/Madden. And 3 Aldel A plastic pipe replacement projects in Barlow, Cleveland, and Eldridge. MDU estimated the investment cost of these 6 2018 projects to be $5.6 million, which is included in the 2018 base rate revenue requirement. Excuse me. Mr. Darras's rebuttal testimony lists 10 SSIP projects for 2018. There are 4 early vintage plastic steel replacement projects in Fairview, Gladstone, New Salem, and Taylor. and there are six early vintage plastic pipe replacement projects in Fairview, Gladstone, New Salem, Barlow, Cleveland, and Eldridge. In both my direct answer rebuttal testimony, I referred to the original six 2018 SSIP projects because those six projects are the projects corresponding to the $5.6 million investment cost that is in MDU's 2018 base rate revenue requirement. And it is the reasonableness, necessity, and prudence of that $5.6 million that I address in my in both my direct testimony and my surrebuttal testimony. In that connection, I also note that according to the SSIP cost documents that MDU provided in response to advocacy staff request 2.5, the total investment cost of the revised list of 10 SSIP projects is approximately $7.4 million.
Thank you. Could you briefly summarize your testimony and recommendations for the commission?
Yes. In my testimony, I find that MDU's revised SSIP plan, as presented in Exhibit PCD2, does not define replacement performance metrics, does not demonstrate a customer benefit, and does not demonstrate that the SSIP is the least cost option for achieving that benefit. But most important, MDU has not demonstrated that the replacement of the 2018 SSIP facilities is reasonable, necessary, and prudent. My recommendation to the Commission is that the 2018 SSIP projects be excluded from MDU's 2018 base rate revenue requirement as not having been shown to be reasonable, necessary, and prudent.
Have you been present in the hearing room since the beginning of the hearing?
Yes, I have.
Have you listened to the testimony before you?
Yes, I have.
Has any of the testimony changed your opinions or recommendations from your pre-filed testimony?
No, it has not.
In the course of preparing your testimony in this case, did you attempt to obtain all information supporting the 2018 projects through data requests and even a WebEx visit with MDU?
Yes, I did.
Okay. What did you find to be missing that you would view as necessary to support the 2018 projects?
What I found to be missing is information concerning the type, vintage, characteristics, and condition of the specific pipe segments in the 2018 SSIP projects. As Ms. Cavisto and Mr. Duras noted several times in testimony yesterday, that information is missing because MDU does not have it.
Thank you. And as far as any other issues, we'll rely on your pre-filed testimony. I'll tender you for cross-examination.
Mr. Sanderson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, Mr. Pavlovic. My name is Paul Sanderson. I represent Montana Dakota in this case. I want to just ask you just a few questions and maybe start with some of the things we agree with. You had no issues with Montana Dakota's depreciation studies that they used as part of this application.
That's right.
Okay. And you had no issues with the allocation of rates of the rate increase to the various classes, correct?
No.
Okay.
Yes, I had no issues.
Okay. I thought I knew what you were saying there, but thank you for clarifying. There's some talk about MDU's use of this minimum systems approach to allocate the cost of mains. You found that their minimum system, the company's minimum system approach, resulted in just and reasonable rates.
The rates being proposed by the company are not mathematically driven by the two different approaches to a cost study. I don't agree with the use of the minimum system, I don't think that is what makes the proposed rates reasonable and just.
And I think we're agreeing on this. The results that MDU reached using what they claim is a minimum systems approach, you believe result in just and reasonable rates?
Looking at the proposed revenue revenue requirement distribution and the approach that the company proposes to distribute the revenue requirement for each class to the various rate elements, I find that to be just and reasonable.
Okay, thank you. Now, I want to get into this basic service charge that you've heard testimony here the last couple days. You're aware, and as part of your direct testimony, you addressed that and are aware that the company is using a straight fixed variable rate design where the costs are implemented to customers on a basic service charge.
The distribution?
Yep.
There is a basic service charge that is used to recover costs.
And you have no concerns regarding this rate design principle?
No, I have no concerns with the rate design principle.
And advocacy staff is not joining AARP in Mr. Rubin's opposition to this basic service charge implementation in this case?
No.
Okay. And advocacy staff is not taking issue with this commission's decision in 2015 to adopt that form of charge to the customers in a basic service charge?
No, staff isn't, and I'm not either.
Let's get to the 2018 main replacement projects. And just so we're clear, you referenced Mr. Darris's SSIP program and the revised copy dated March 15th, 2018?
Exhibit PCD.
PCD 2.
Yes.
Okay, and you said it identified six early vintage plastic pipe projects. That you referenced that?
Yes.
Okay, and those six are Gladstone, Fairview, New Salem, Eldridge, Barlow, and Cleveland. Those are the communities? And I'll refer you to page 9 of 18.
Yeah, I can look at page 9 or I can look what I wrote down, but in any event, it's complicated enough that I want to look at what I wrote down.
Fair enough.
The six vintage plastic, early vintage plastic pipe replacement projects are Fairview, Gladstone, New Salem, Barlow, Cleveland, and Eldridge.
Okay. And then you said Montana, Dakota, and Mr. Darris included four early vintage steel pipe projects, correct?
That's correct.
And those four are Fairview, Gladstone, New Salem, and Taylor.
That's correct.
Okay. So three of those four are communities where the early vintage steel and early vintage plastic pipe will be replaced?
Apparently, yes.
Okay. And you're aware that the company has requested approximately $5.6 million revenue request for these 2018 projects?
No, my understanding is that the company estimates $5.6 million for the original six projects, three early vintage steel replacement they're not early vintage steel replacement. They were denominated low pressure system replacement projects. And that was in New Salem, Taylor, and Bismarck Mandan. And then there were three Aldo A plastic pipe replacement projects, and they were in Barlow, Cleveland, and Eldridge.
Okay. And you're talking...
These numbers and these projects are listed in Attachment C to MDU's response to staff's data request 2.5.
Okay. And you're referring to what was originally proposed?
Yeah, because it's my understanding that those are the projects that are in the revenue requirement.
And then some of these projects were revised by Mr. Darris to include the seven he sat and testified to yesterday.
Effectively, what was done, let me refer to another piece of paper that I've prepared, unless I've lost it. Let's take a look at Mr. Darris's exhibit PCD-2, if I can find it. Let's see, Mr. Hudson Buller. I'm looking at page 10 of PCD-2.
Certainly.
This is what I understand Mr. Darris to have testified to yesterday. It's what he testified to in his sir rebuttal testimony. As near as I can tell, effectively what has happened here is that the original six projects, the Aldo A replacement projects in Barlow, Cleveland, and Eldridge have been relabeled early vintage plastic replacements. The Bismarck-Mandan low-pressure system replacement project has been moved out of 2018, and the Mandan project has been placed in 2019. The Dickinson low pressure, is it Dickinson?
And
this
I think
is confusing.
But eventually,
essentially what has happened is that the Bismarck-Mandan has been moved out of the 2018 time frame, and the Gladstone has been added for steel replacement, and New Salem and Fairview as well. And New Salem and Taylor are no longer low-pressure system replacement. They've been turned into two projects, I presume because the low-pressure system in Salem and Taylor consists of both cathodically protected steel and plastic. And that's how you end up with more projects.
Certainly. And my question was very simply, Mr. Pavlovic. You heard Mr. Darris testify to the seven projects that he's seeking in the 2018 main and system line replacement projects.
Right.
Okay. And the dollars from the original filing, the $5.6 million, has not changed at any point in time, correct?
Well, MDU hasn't changed it.
Certainly. And you are also aware, Mr. Pavlovic, that as part of this project, the company proposed in 2019 coming back in front of this commission to true up the 2018 cost to make sure they accurately reflect what was being put in the ground in 2018. You're aware of that?
Yes, I'm aware of that.
Okay. Now, let's talk about this. Your testimony, as I understand it, is all of the cost of these seven 2018 projects that Mr. Darris identified should be disallowed by this commission.
They should be disallowed for recovery through base rates.
Okay. And your rationale for disallowing these seven projects is they are not reasonable, they are not necessary, and they are not prudent.
No justification has been provided for doing this other than that MDU wants to change out its low pressure system, and it wants to replace all its Aldo A pipe.
Okay, and they've explained to you their rationale for doing that is a safety concern. You're aware of that?
Yes, I'm aware of that. I'm also aware that they have presented no evidence suggesting that the low pressure systems constitute a high risk threat to their system.
Okay. Let's talk about you also You're also aware, with respect to the plastic pipe projects, you're aware of the $5.6 million, only a small portion of those costs, roughly 15%, go to replacement of plastic pipes in the towns of Eldridge, Barlow, and Cleveland. You heard that testimony?
Yes, I did hear that testimony.
And you also heard the testimony that the company intends to take 35 samples from Eldridge, which they believe is mainly 1971 pipe, from Barlow, which is mainly 1981 pipe, and from Cleveland, that is mainly unknown vintage plastic pipe, and submit it to third-party testing. You heard that testimony?
Yes, I heard that as part of the replacement, they are intending to test certain portions of the system.
And those costs of testing are included in the roughly $800,000 worth of replacement of plastic pipe, correct?
I heard Mr. Darris testify to that effect.
And it's your opinion, then, that Montana Dakota testing these early vintage plastic pipes as part of these projects would not be reasonable, necessary, and prudent as a natural gas operator in the state of North Dakota?
Testing the system does not require replacement of the system.
I'm just saying the test, you want to throw out all the testing costs as not being necessary, prudent, and reasonable, correct?
No, I want the cost thrown out. Let's not be too colloquial. I think that the cost of the replacement should be excluded. Well, if MDU feels that this testing program is an appropriate expenditure and is justified by safety concerns, then they should spend those dollars. Well, whether they should be recovered through base rates or through the SSIP program is a different question.
Well, let's talk about your opinions, Mr. Pavlovic. Could you explain to this commission why the 2018 project in Cleveland needs to be thrown out, but you have no issues with the 2017 replacement project in Richardton?
Was the 2017 project done under the SSIP?
It absolutely was. It was identified under the program as early vintage steel and plastic pipe. Why is the advocacy staff not have an issue?
Is there a document?
My question.
You're asking me to answer your hypothetical question, assuming that this project in Richardson was in fact designed and undertaken under the SSIP, a program that, as I understand it, wasn't in existence then.
My question, Mr. Pavlovic, was simply, can you explain why advocacy staff has an issue with the Cleveland replacement project of early vintage steel and early vintage plastic in 2018, but you're not seeking exclusion or disallowance of the company's main and system replacement of early vintage steel and early vintage plastic pipe in Richardton in 2017.
If that replacement was undertaken as a normal operations of MDU and not as a result of a safety concern, which hasn't been demonstrated, then it belongs in rate base.
Okay. Explain why the advocacy staff and you have no issue with the Bismarck 13th Street project that was replacing early vintage steel and early vintage plastic pipe in 2017.
I don't know anything about that project.
Well, it's included in the 2017 rate base.
As I said, I don't know anything about that project.
Well, in Montana, Dakota in 2015 spent approximately $2 million in main and system replacement projects, and the advocacy staff and you are not taking any issue or seeking a disallowance of any of the 2015 projects, correct?
I would say at this point, I'm assuming that it was that was a prudent replacement, that it wasn't undertaken, or that it was undertaken because in fact there was an existing demonstrable threat to safety on that particular portion of the system.
Can you describe? Can you explain what projects were done in 2015 on replacement?
No, I didn't. I didn't examine those.
Okay. In 2016, the company spent and is seeking a recovery of approximately $1.6 million in its rate base for 2016 projects. Did you examine those to determine their reasonableness, necessary, and prudent evaluation?
No, I was only examining the projects that were listed as SSIP projects.
And it was implied in some questioning earlier in this hearing to Ms. Cavisto and Mr. Darris that advocacy staff has never had an issue at any time before with the company's replacement projects. But now that the company is trying to formulate a detailed plan to address these concerns in an SSIP, all of a sudden, advocacy staff wants to throw out every project?
Checked as a misstatement of our position, but
it's a misstatement of any position I've taken in testimony. But in any event, I will respond to it.
There's a disconnect here.
Yeah.
Why in 2018 are these replacement projects not reasonable, necessary, and prudent?
They haven't been shown to be reasonable, necessary, or prudent. That is my testimony. It isn't the other one.
One of the things, Mr. Pavlovic, you testified to earlier was that MDU is missing data regarding the type, vintage, and characteristics of the pipe in the 2018 projects. That was your testimony?
No, my testimony is that that is a very accurate characterization of MDU's system knowledge of its North Dakota distribution system.
Certainly. And you heard Mr. Darris testify that much, or not much, but certainly portions of its system were pre-code, and it doesn't know what has been in there because it's been in so long before the system and accurate records were kept. Did you hear that testimony?
I already know that they don't have the records for their system. It was demonstrated to me in the WebEx demo.
Certainly, there's portions of their system that they don't have records that were put in before the necessary record-keeping system was put in place. It's so old it precedes that.
That's right.
Okay. And you're criticizing their programs in 2018 that they don't have the necessary data when you know they don't have the necessary data and there's no way for them to have that data. Am I accurately reflecting your criticism?
I'm just saying that there's no data has been. There's two issues here, actually. The pipeline regulations that govern the distribution integrity management plan. Okay. Those regulations require gas distribution systems to complete their system knowledge, to undertake such steps as are necessary to complete their knowledge of their system. Having done that, then they are to identify threats. MDU doesn't have any idea. My understanding of the record keeping under the Uniform Standard of Accounts system of accounts requires you to have kept records of what you put in the ground, what it was. I mean, pre-code, why MDU doesn't have those records, I don't know what I can speculate as to why they don't, but apparently they don't. I mean, the DIMP specifically says you to use your records, you to use your normal leak surveys and other survey techniques of your system. Use the data that you get when there is a leak, when there's an excavation leak, or any other kind of leak that you repair to improve your system knowledge,
and
your knowledge of your system. What I'm saying is, let me finish. At the WebEx demonstration of the GIS, which is really remarkable. It's a beautiful system, okay? And I don't know if people are familiar with what a GIS actually is, but it's just a geographical representation of a system. It's digital. You click on a pipe segment, and up comes a menu, and it has all the information that there is for the thing. When I was at the WebEx, I was asking, I don't remember the name of the person who undertook it. I don't know if Mr. Darris was there or who it was. But anyway, they were showing me this thing. I would point out a pipe segment, and I would ask, well, what's there? They'd pop it up. Most of the entries would be empty. So I don't know what it is. And after a while, whoever it was that was conducting the WebEx said, well, we'll find out when we replace it. Well, yeah, obviously, you will find out what's there when you replace it because you'll be able to record what's in there. My question is wholesale replacement a proper way to perfect your system knowledge, or should you, I really hate making speeches, or should you be continuing to perfect your knowledge through the normal operating methods, possibly using sampling of things, but I don't think that wholesale replacement of the system is a proper, prudent, or reasonable way of perfecting your system knowledge.
Now, Mr. Pavlovic, you're certainly aware that is exactly why Montana Dakota selected three of its smallest projects of differing age pipe in Eldridge, Barlow, and Cleveland to test and study. You're aware of that?
If the testing and studying is being done for that purpose, then I would revise my recommendation and say that that should be allowed
now
into the base rates. But just the testing, again, replacement is not the way is not a reasonable, prudent, or necessary way to improve your system knowledge and determine what threats actually exist on your system.
Now, Mr. Pavlovic, you were present today when you heard AARP's expert testify that public safety is the number one concern for the AARP. Did you hear that testimony?
Yes, I heard that testimony. Okay.
Do you agree that public safety is the number one concern for advocacy staff?
I would say that public safety is the number one concern for everyone involved in the utility industry, and it is usually marked in regulations.
Okay. And along those lines, Mr. Pavlovic, are you aware in the past few months there was a natural gas explosion in Cleveland?
No, I was not aware of that.
Okay. As being here on behalf of advocacy staff and the consumers...
Cleveland, North Dakota.
Cleveland, North Dakota, not Ohio. In Cleveland, North Dakota, being here on behalf of all of North Dakota gas customers, did you talk to anybody in Cleveland to see if they believe the replacement project of these early vintage steel and plastic pipe in Cleveland is reasonable, necessary, and prudent?
That isn't information I would gather in determining whether it's prudent.
And I think
necessary.
It was a simple question. Did you attempt to talk to anybody from Cleveland or any customers from that community to see if they'd believe it's reasonable, prudent, and necessary?
Not knowing about the explosion, no, I did not speak with them.
In any other of the other six communities that are getting replacement of their aging natural gas infrastructure. Did you speak to any of those customers to determine whether they believe these projects are reasonable, necessary, and prudent?
No, I did not.
Relevance, Judge. I was talking to people in the community to tell whether the projects are reasonable or prudent.
Sustained.
Now, I want to get into your testimony, specifically get past the 2018 projects and more into the SSIP mechanism. You recognize that recovery mechanisms have been implemented across the country in a number of states to deal with aging infrastructure issues.
I'm aware of a number of programs and associated recovery mechanisms to replace aging infrastructure for safety reasons.
Okay. And in fact, it's your testimony that put in the January 2017 U.S. Department of Energy report.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And in your Exhibit 1, the 2017 Department of Energy report, it indicates that 39 states have adopted some form of recovery or program similar to MDU's SSIP. And I'm not talking the details, but have adopted some form of
accelerated replacement program for infrastructure for safety reasons. In some jurisdictions, it's been for reliability reasons.
So we're in agreement, roughly 39 states have adopted some form of the program?
Yes.
Okay.
They have performed. I think I need to be really clear. There are, in a number of jurisdictions, there have been proposed and accepted a large number. It's probably 39, but I haven't bothered to count the exact number there, but I will rely on you. Programs to replace infrastructure at an accelerated pace, that is, before it has reached the end of its life, for safety or reliability reasons.
And some of those states specifically call out the Aldele-A pipe, correct?
Yes, some states mention some in the program. In some states, the program specifically mentions Aldele.
And in your direct testimony on
page, excuse me, the Aldele-A vintages that were made with the resin, which promotes brittleness and cracking.
Okay. And on page 7 of your direct testimony, you identify there were two primary purposes for these infrastructure accelerated replacement programs. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And the first of those reasons for adopting a program similar to this is to accelerate the replacement of targeted infrastructure for safety or reliability purposes. That's in your testimony?
That's in my testimony, and it's also what I just testified to.
And the second main rationale for adopting these programs is to accelerate gas utility infrastructure cost recovery outside of base rate proceedings.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Do you agree adoption of a program in North Dakota has the potential to accelerate replacement of targeted infrastructure for safety and reliability purposes?
It doesn't have the potential. If you adopt such a program here in North Dakota, it will.
Okay. And also, agreeing with or recognizing that, it also would allow a gas utility infrastructure recovery outside of rate base. It would accelerate that recovery if a program was adopted in North Dakota.
Yes, that's what investment trackers do. They accelerate recovery of the investment that the utility makes. R- rather than having to wait to, for a rate case to do a prudence review and have it accepted into rate base.
One of the criticisms you had of Montana Dakota's SSIP is a lack of customer benefit. That's one of your stated criticisms.
A lack of a demonstration of customer benefit.
Okay. And you don't see any benefit to the customer of replacing 50-plus-year-old pipe?
Solely on the basis of being 50 years old? No.
Okay. It serves no benefit to get an 50-plus-year-old pipe, or as Mr. Darris's 1939 coupling out of the ground and replacing it with a newer fitting that serves no benefit to the customer.
It serves no benefit to the customer if that particular piece of facilities hasn't reached its end of life.
Okay. Now, is advocacy staff taking the position that this commission does not have the authority to adopt an SSIP program?
Judge, I got to object. He doesn't speak for all of advocacy staff.
Sustained.
Okay.
Ask him his opinion.
Well, Judge, who do I question on advocacy staff if they're putting up witnesses? I mean,
question him about his opinion. He's an expert. He's given opinions.
He's here to give an opinion. Ask him what his opinions are. We know who he's working for.
That's why I don't understand, but I will certainly address it as you instruct. Is it your opinion, Mr. Pavlovic, here testifying on behalf of advocacy staff, that this commission does not have the authority to adopt accelerated replacement program?
No.
Okay.
It clearly has the authority. That's why we're here today.
Okay. So you agree that if this commission deemed it appropriate, they have the full authority to adopt an accelerated replacement program similar to 39 other states?
That's my understanding.
Okay. Are you opposed? You personally opposed to an accelerated recovery mechanism outside of a full rate case?
No.
Okay. Now, you were present when AARP's witness testified, and he said, I've never seen a rider or mechanism like this that he's comfortable with. So you believe, under the right circumstances, it would be appropriate?
Yes.
Okay. And that gets to the question, Mr. Pavlovic, and what program parameters would you, as the witness on behalf of advocacy staff, want included in an accelerated replacement program to make it acceptable to this commission for the benefit of North Dakota customers for safety reasons?
Well, if we're talking about the tracker mechanism, there ought to be a plan, a schedule. There needs to be a definition of the eligible facilities, an evidentiary-based definition of the eligible facilities. I'm personally opposed to this, but as an expert, but when these things were originally put in place, they were viewed, and it really is the way to view a tracker. It is just a mini revenue requirement. It's just like it's the same questions and the same calculations that you do when you do a base rate. Fundamental principle of rate making is recovery doesn't begin until the plant is in service and useful, used and useful. So when these programs were originally put in place, it was the company informed the commission with a report that it was going to make the following replacements. A year later, when they had done the replacements and it was possible to address the question, is it used and useful and in service, then it was reviewed for prudency, and then recovery began. What has evolved is to define. Companies did not like that arrangement. They wanted to start recovery immediately, even before the stuff was in the ground. So there were a couple jurisdictions in which it was actually done by legislation at the behest of the utilities. The company, commissions were instructed basically to define the year in which something went into service as the instant in which it went into service, so that if something was going to go into service in 2018, the company could begin recovering for that investment on January 1st of that year. So what has happened is that, and this is probably what you should do, this is what I would recommend if you're going to approve this kind of a mechanism, is something like what the company has proposed here in testimony. I haven't seen it anywhere really in writing, which is the company makes a filing with the commission, says these are the projects we're going to put in service for the next year. This is the cost. This is what we estimate the cost will be. We calculate the revenue requirement, and you need a more specific, in the tariff, you need a more specific statement of what is going to be used to calculate the revenue requirement. And then they can begin recovery, even though the stuff is not in the ground yet. Then at the end of the year, the company makes a true-up filing in which they provide the documentation for the replacements and the cost, and you can do a real it's like the first filing is like an advanced determination of prudence. It just gives the presumption of prudence to something that the company does. The second filing is where you actually determine that this was a prudent investment and that it's used and useful in service, and that true up is then carried over to the next period. There probably should be a cap on the amount that can be recovered from this. This is frequent, and the reasons are various, but gradualism is as good as another. And there should also be a requirement after a certain period. It should be the investment should be taken out of the tracker and put into base rates.
Now, Mr. Pavlovic, I want to follow up on those. You're aware, at least with respect to the testimony and information the companies indicated, their intent is to make filings with the commission and identify the projects each year and costs, consistent with what you said would be appropriate.
That's sort of what I understood the MDU's witnesses to be saying the last day and a half, yes. Yep.
And you also heard MDU's witnesses testify that there would be no recovery under this accelerated SSIP mechanism until the commission approved the project. Do you agree that would be an appropriate method?
The two filings that I mentioned, that's basically what happens with the initial filing.
Okay. And another thing you indicated is in your statement was you believe a true-up filing should occur. Now, you're aware, right in the tariff, Tariff 94 discusses the company coming back to the commission to true up all actual costs. That's something they're proposing.
Yeah, I'm aware of that.
Okay.
I don't think it's very well laid out in the tariff, but...
But those adding these requirements or parameters would make an accelerated replacement program similar to the SSIP more acceptable to you, in your opinion?
This is a loose definition of an appropriate tracker cost recovery mechanism for any kind of replacement program. But I keep coming back to, I do not believe that the company has, I don't think that they're able at this point to demonstrate that they have portions of their system that are a specific threat simply because that happens to be old or simply because it happens to be al-delay. There's lots of al-delay vintages out there that weren't made with the resin that gives the propensity to brittleness and cracking.
Now, Mr. Pavlovic, following up on your what you think is appropriate, you provided the document that identifies 39 other states that have some form of this. What states, in your expert experience, have a model that you believe is appropriate that this commission could look at to have the parameters that you think are important in developing a system like this?
I would name Massachusetts and Maryland, but only because I'm the most familiar with those. I think there are similar mechanisms in place in New Jersey.
Can you just describe maybe a couple functions of each of those states' recovery system that you believe are appropriate or should be adopted?
They're the ones that I just listed for you.
Yeah, including some of the things, a cap and a requirement to get to the projects moved into rate base.
Yep.
The next. Have you looked at Montana, Dakota's riders for electricity?
No, I have not.
Okay. You're aware that North Dakota does have a rider mechanism for certain projects, environmental projects on the electricity, for environmental and transmission projects?
I understand that to be the case based on other people's testimony today.
Okay. So just so I'm clear, Mr. Pavlovic, with respect to your opinion, you're not fundamentally opposed to the SSIP. You just would like certain parameters in place to make it acceptable.
The cost recovery, that what you just said, a cost recovery mechanism can be very easily made acceptable, whether either the commission or advocacy staff wants to get involved in that is another question. I will continue in answer to your questions to draw a sharp distinction between the recovery mechanism and whatever the program is.
Well, you just made a comment whether a commission wants to get involved in this type of project, but you're aware 39 other commissions across the country have made the decision to get involved in this significant public safety issue.
Yeah, and I can tell you because I actually happen to participate and will be participating in two more in the next month, two of these processes in Massachusetts, and they are a significant burden.
Mr. Pavlovic, I have no further questions. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Kaufman.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon. So are you aware of the 30-some jurisdictions that have an accelerated infrastructure replacement program? How many of those also include a surcharge?
My knowledge, they all include a surcharge of one sort or another.
Are you aware?
That's the point. I mean, these programs. There are the safety programs, and there are the recovery programs, the recovery mechanisms, and almost every accelerated replacement program that I'm aware of has an accelerated recovery mechanism.
Okay. Well, do you have any doubt that MDU could engage upon a program that prioritizes and accelerates main replacements without having to piecemeal it out through a surcharge and its cost recovery and recover it through the general normal full audit rate case review?
I think that they could implement this program without this accelerated recovery. The area in the jurisdictions that I'm familiar with this, the argument for the accelerated recovery has been made by the utilities. I've never really understood how this works, but that hasn't kept commissions from approving it, arguing that they needed the accelerated recovery in order to obtain the funds to get the to replace the stuff.
Does that make sense to you?
I have some problems with it. But utilities have three sources of investment. They have the internally generated free cash flow. They can borrow money or they can issue stock. And most utilities, in fact, use all three methods. And if the utility is saying that internally generated funds aren't sufficient, I mean, that's an empirical question, and you have to look into the facts.
But isn't the cost recovery really more a matter of timing and regulatory lag than it is safety?
The recovery is. Yeah. The recovery isn't anything about safety unless you tie it to safety by saying, I have to make these replacements for safety reasons, and the only way I can get the capital to do it is to have the accelerated recovery. Yeah. Now, whether that's the case for MDU, I don't know.
And isn't regulatory lag virtually eliminated in the state of North Dakota because of the interim rate mechanism?
Well, there's a certain portion of it, the regulatory lag exists as long as they operate under a given set of rates and don't come in for a new rate case.
And isn't there a positive impact for the public of regulatory lag?
Oh, yes. The regulatory lag is definitely, it's part of the traditional regulatory model. If you don't have regulatory lag, the company has no incentive to seek efficiency gains.
And over time, there can be under-earnings and over-earnings, and so regulatory lag could work to the benefit of either the customer or the utility.
That's also true.
Right. Okay. That's all I have.
I want to expand on my answer to your second-to-last question. The tracker mechanisms do two things. They eliminate regulatory lag. They also guarantee a return. It's the guarantee of the return that I object to most. That's my answer.
Thank you.
Okay, Major.
No questions, sir.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
I don't want to oversimplify, but forget the tracker for a couple of minutes. Just talk about the investment.
I'd love to do that.
Yeah. Basically, what you're saying, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the company has simply not met its burden here, not proved its case here.
They're making these replacements.
Okay.
That's my testimony.
That's all I have. Thanks.
Commissioner Crocious.
Okay, I'm going to move through these very quickly. But some of this will be repetitive. But you don't believe that currently MDU's system poses a safety risk, or we don't know?
Well, it's my understanding there aren't many incidents. What incidents there are due to the majority of them are due to excavation damage. This is according to their DIMP and according to their 7100 reports. I don't see that any evidence has been presented that suggests that there is any portion of their system that poses an imminent threat.
And you believe there is ample opportunity to still do the testing, the sampling of the various types of pipe through regular maintenance and repair of the system?
Plus this firm GTI is doing. I mean, you know, it could make sense to go out and sample the systems to determine what's there. My point, that will not be nearly as expensive as replacing the system.
Would this be considered a normal part of doing business, repairs and maintenance?
Repairs and maintenance are a normal part of doing business, and that is the normal way that a gas utility updates its information about its system.
What about the time frame argument that was made yesterday? In terms of even if the system is going, if some of this vintage, early vintage pipe is going to no longer be good 20, 30 years from now, you really have to start now without significantly impacting consumers down the road.
No, I just don't think it's right. I mean, that amounts to saying, this is, on what basis, I don't know, is that this is a danger that is so large that we just can't wait to address it.
So now is not, so the 39 states, are they jumping the gun
many of those states, the early adopters were reacting to the San Bernardino and stuff like that. And they were reacting to the fact, and most of them were in the East Coast. Most of them had, I mean, some of them still do, significant amount of their distribution system consists of wrought iron, cast iron, and bare steel. The cast iron, the problem with cast iron, this is the Allentown problem. The problem with cast iron is that it's very brittle. You can dig a hole near a cast iron main, and some of the earth can fall underneath it, and it'll crack of its own weight. Cast iron is basically bad stuff. It can break at any point. It can also last for hundreds of years. And bare steel too is bare steel in most environments corrodes really fast, right? So these programs, the early ones, were to replace types of material that had that you knew they were just bad stuff and that something could happen at any moment. The later ones, and aldolay has been added to this, but again, it's only a certain vintage. There's no problem with later versions of it. And it's even, my understanding is there are vintages of it that did not use this one resin, which apparently creates the potential for this brittle cracking. So you could have stuff that's vintage 1970, and it's not a problem at all. As it's sort of spread west, you started encountering I've started encountering utilities proposing to replace low pressure systems, and the reasons are various. It's both safety and reliability and stuff like that. But I guess what I'm saying is the early adopters, they were reacting to a very real and present danger. The late adopters are, you know, it's like MDU's proactive approach. But again, it's based on their system knowledge. It's based on being able to demonstrate that a portion of their system, in fact, poses a threat.
And everything you read, that detail is clearly lacking.
It appears to be that it's clearly lacking here. Okay. And there's no, I mean, again, I mean, how many incidents, you know, what is their leak rate? I saw nothing in the DIMP. I saw nothing in the 7100 reports that suggests that there's some portion of their system that is about to become a very real danger.
Out of the 5.6 million, 800,000 is for third-party testing of the pipe.
I think that's actually for replacement, too.
For replacement as well.
The third-party testing is...
The 800?
I don't know what it is, but okay. It's presumably a smaller number.
Well, whatever that smaller number is, could it be argued that that should be a part of regular repairs and maintenance, that testing would be a part of that? Or do you think that the current situation with the potential with resin, or at least the wrong type of resin having been used during the manufacturing process, do you think that in itself is enough to look at that as an above and beyond expense, or embedded within that's just a normal part of maintaining a system is periodic testing of the material?
Well, they periodic testing of the material, that is not a normal thing. They are under the obligation to improve their knowledge of their system, of what they've got where, and the condition. And, I mean, that's the federal government, but you should really be holding them to that as well. And I think, within reason, I would say any expense that they undertake in order to get their system knowledge up to where it should be, that should be part of their normal operations of operating and maintenance. The NICOR utilities have been trying to get a tracker, the gas utilities, I'm sorry, NiSource. The NiSource utilities have tried on a number of occasions on the East Coast to get a tracker in for the expenses, not the investment, but the expenses of getting their system knowledge up to the federal requirement. To my knowledge, commissions have consistently said, no, you know, that's just an expense and it's covered in your rates.
So this is, and this to wrap up, this is essentially, and I don't want to oversimplify this, but is this like having a set of tires that are 60,000-mile tires that still have 30,000 miles remaining on the tread? And yes, it would be safer to put new tires on, but you have to balance that with economics?
Well, economics is one of the things that you have. I mean, because you're talking about rates, and you're required to balance it with
right.
with economics. But I think that that's the case. I mean, there's no, again, they presented no evidence that suggests that overall their system is just fine. If they can identify the all-delay threat, that seems fine. They know the rate at which their steel, their low-pressure steel, is corroding and the rate at which it needs to be replaced. It may be that the case can be made that some of these low-pressure systems, the steel portion, should be replaced just because they've reached the end of their life. But Mr. Rubin made reference to their depreciation study. The depreciation study, those are average service lives that you're looking at there. The truth of the matter is that some pipe goes bad the day you put it in the ground, and some pipe will last 100 years. You know, and that's just the way it is and the way it has always been with gas utilities. So there's a certain rate at which stuff fails, and you have to replace it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Chairman Chrisman.
Before I lose track of that, expand on that. So something fails, and you have to replace it, but do you replace that small segment? Or is that an indicator, and when a bunch of those indicators add up with that there's been failures of that type of product, that then those should be replaced more quickly?
Okay, I have to preface this by saying I am not an engineer, okay? But I've worked alongside a lot of utilities over the years and utility engineers. My understanding, the way gas utilities work, that do periodic, these are the things that happen. Somebody digs a hole and breaks a line. You now have a leak. It's got to be repaired. Somebody smells gas. The gas company comes out and discovers there's a leak. Plus, utilities routinely, I believe MDU is on a year cycle, do leak surveys where they actually go over the lines with leak detectors. When a leak is detected, it's one of three classes, but one is you don't have to do anything about it. It's not big enough to worry about it. Two is that it needs to be fixed, but it doesn't need to be fixed immediately, and then there's what needs to be fixed right now. Most leaks are repaired. They don't involve investment. They don't take the pipe out and put a new pipe in. It's almost like when you can reach a point where you've got so many repairs on a segment of pipe that that the repairs have become a danger, and then you replace it. That's the way gas utilities operate.
And then to clarify and see if I understood right, based on one of Commissioner Karasius's questions, I understood the 800,000 distinction was for the replacement and the testing of plastic pipes, and that the remainder, the 4.some million, had to do with steel pipe replacement.
That's my understanding as well.
Okay. And did I sense right that toward the end of your discussion with Mr. Sanderson, there was kind of a sense that you'd have some temperance for a program as has been discussed here in testimony, but not so much laid out in the advance testimony, where the company would come in the spring with a list of proposed projects, get approval, put them in, and true up in the fall, similar to a ADP process?
Yeah, that's the way to do it if you want to allow the company to go on a systematic replacement program. Where you, in essence, determine on the make prudency decisions on the fly, as opposed to waiting for a rate case and then making a big prudence decision. And that's the way to do it. If you think that it's justified for them to undertake a replacement program, then this is a good way to implement it through a recovery mechanism. You could also throw out the recovery mechanism. You could just have them say, look, you're going to come in each year and you're going to file, and when it gets so big, that you need to reduce your rate to increase your rates because the investment has grown, then you come in for a rate case. I mean, it is true. There are downsides to these trackers, but for sure, as an investment, as a driver of rate cases, if you have one of these things in place, it will reduce that driver for a rate case.
Okay. And based on your knowledge, and I don't know how much it is of our agency, most of the Public Utilities Division, who has been in the room today, do you think that it would be necessary, if we were to operate a system like that, to have a filing fee so that the commission could hire professional staff to help determine the prudency of those projects?
I think that's absolutely necessary because it is an effort. It takes money. It takes resources. It doesn't take anything if all you're going to do is rubber stamp it. But I would strongly recommend that you institute a fee.
Okay, and so especially with the plastic portion, because if I understood it correctly, the steel portion of the 2018 projects are just strictly replacement. I didn't understand that there's really going to be testing on that material.
That was my understanding, too.
Okay, and so on the plastic portion, where part of the $800,000 will be for testing, do you think there's even a possibility that testing will show that there is some certain material out there, and then they might conclude, okay, that was put in at a certain time, and so, you know, certain towns would have the same thing, that then that would indicate a more dire need and a safety cause to go ahead and do those quickly?
If the testing determines, and this is a testing problem, okay? It's a probability and random samples and extrapolating to other portions of the system. But if they are able to identify that they actually have the vintage of Aldolay that is subject to brittleness and joint cracking, then they should replace it.
And so,
and they can make the case. I mean, they can make the case, you know, based on the testing, and so, you know, whether, you know, you can to what extent you can extrapolate out to these other areas.
And so, is the original SSIP program requested, is that just something that's ahead of its time, that it should have been do the 2018 projects, get the testing, and then build the SSIP program around fixing those things that the testing indicated are in fact a safety problem?
That's what I believe. I mean, I believe that you have to be able to demonstrate, number one, that the target is there, that the threat is there, and that you know where the threat is. At that point, when you know those two things, then it's appropriate to institute this kind of a replacement program, and it's probably appropriate, balancing everything, to allow for a tracker recovery. As long as it's periodically moved, that investment is periodically moved into rate base.
Okay. No other questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
I have so many books I can't get close to my mic.
You hold it.
Here we go. So yesterday the company provided testimony that basically, industry standards and federal regulations are driving a change in the way they approach pipeline safety and integrity. Would you agree with that? That's what they testified?
I agree that
they needed a more systematic and holistic approach.
Yes, and I would actually I agree with that.
Because PHMSA, you agree that PHMSA is requiring that now?
Yeah.
Okay. So is this SSIP basically, because advocacy staff and you, I don't want to get into characterizing whether it's the whole staff or just your opinion, but...
Well, they'll adopt whatever, what they want of what I tell you.
It seems that you, at least, are objecting to the SSIP in favor more of their standard operating procedure that they've pursued in the, you know, normal course of business over the last couple of decades.
Well, that's the best source of improving their knowledge of their system. But, I think it's clear that they need to do more than that.
Okay.
This is a complicated issue about, you know, going back and drawing on. I don't know the nature of their records. I do know that they're supposed to have kept records, according to the Uniform Standard of Accounts, of various things. But in particular, the nature and the vintage of what they put in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, if they don't have them, they don't have them. I mean, we have to deal with reality, right?
If they don't have them, they don't have them. In which case, you've got to figure out some other way to get that knowledge. And I said sampling is one of them. I mean, they routinely go out and dig up and repair leaks. I don't know what the expense is. They would have to tell you. It might be big enough that it would be appropriate to put it in a tracker, an expense tracker, not an investment tracker.
Yes.
But in any event, I mean, you know, they do this all the time. They go and they dig up a segment and they repair it. Well, you know, you go up and dig up a segment, replace that piece and send it for testing.
So I want to separate the tracker and the recovery mechanism from just the pipeline safety, their operations, for the purpose of my questions for now. So if it strikes me that this SSIP is the standard operating procedure of the future. It's now it has a name, but it is where the industry standards and PHMSA is pushing companies to go as a standard way of operating. Is that a wrong a conclusion?
No, I think that's absolutely right. Again, to take the example of Massachusetts, which is what I'm most familiar with, most gas utilities have a series of programs, operating procedures that result in replacing facilities. And in Massachusetts, what the companies have done is that they've just added another one. It's called the Safety Replacement Program.
Mm-hmm.
And it's focused on identifying, you know, safety issues. And
what other issues for replacement are there? We just don't like how it looks anymore?
No, stuff wears,
I mean,
stuff,
why else do you replace
stuff? Stuff wears out.
And it's not safe.
Hold on. We got to talk one at a time for the court order. We're really doing it a lot here lately.
If it's damaged, it's not safe, so you replace it. If it wears out, it's not safe, so you replace it. I mean, I can't think of any other reason that this stuff gets replaced if it isn't for safety.
That's the ambiguity that people plant. No, it's true. No. Sometimes you replace stuff because you have to increase the capacity because you're adding load.
Sure. That's good. Okay, so if this is sort of the new way of managing the system and making sure it's safe, we're kind of trying to figure out what's the prudent way for them to increase the knowledge, and how do they do that? How can they? I mean, you've suggested that the sampling is one way. How else? Because in the PCD 2, page 2 of this, page 4 of 18 of Darris's, of the SIP plan as it stands, they basically say that page 4, so it's page 4 of 18 as listed on the top. Don't look at those bottom ones. That's confusing. So to see that paragraph in the middle, early vintage steel pipe. So these pipes are being slated for replacement to eliminate aging and obsolete, bare steel or poorly coated pipe, pipe with unknown attributes or missing data, gas meters located indoors, and or mechanical couplings and fittings. Yesterday, it seemed to me in the testimony from the company that they admitted that the steel probably isn't worn out as much as they're concerned about the couplings and the fittings. Did you hear that?
I did.
So how does, if they don't have the records to show where there's these couplings and fittings, where all this stuff is, and I'm not trying to defend their position, I'm just trying to understand, like, what are the other alternatives if you're going to dig it all up to find that? Then you just survey it and cover it back up again, or what should we be doing to increase the knowledge on the system? Yeah.
My understanding is that if the coupling is failing, the coupling, for example, is failing, it'll result in a leak. That's what that's what practically everything on a gas system, when it fails, it results in a leak, and it ought to show up in the leak surveys that they make. Said that they do that MDU does it on an annual basis, mm-hmm. but I know there are utilities that do it on a semi-annual basis.
So, is there concerns with waiting for leaks to be the driver of replacement? Is there safety concerns with that? What if it's a really slow leak in a downtown area and you've got?
Then it's not a hazard.
If a leak's if I leave my grill on for a little bit amount, a short amount of time, and then start it. Or if I leave it on, it's leaking a little bit, I come to start it, it's going to create a huge
problem. That's
your
grill. It's not their system.
Well, what I'm...
This is why they perform the leak surveys and why they categorize them. I mean, when they identify a leak, they determine whether it's one that needs to be repaired at all. If it needs to be repaired, it's because it's sufficient enough that gas is accumulating someplace and could possibly ignite.
So if it's a slow leak, it doesn't accumulate enough to cause a problem?
That's the
theory?
You should ask MDU, but my understanding is that that's the way gas utilities work. Mm-hmm. I mean, because it is. I mean, gas leaks are detected. I mean, gas leaks are they're both the problem and they're the indicator of a problem.
Okay. So more leak surveys would be another suggestion that you would maybe twice a year, not once.
You know, determine how frequently they need to do.
Okay.
Leak surveys.
They
may be doing them sufficiently. I mean, an annual survey may be sufficient. In which case, what it tells you is that there aren't many problems occurring on their system.
You've multiple times said there just isn't the justification, and there aren't customer benefits shown. So what more do we need from them what should we be asking for to justify these investments?
The customer benefit, Like I said, typically the customer benefit is tied to the importance to instituting the surcharge tracker mechanism. But having said that, I think you should be. I think you should be requiring them to complete their DIMP. The DIMP document is in the response to staff's 3.2, and it's actually kind of interesting reading. But in any event, they list their action items, the things that they're doing, and they should be telling you what can we do. MDU should be telling you, if we do this, we can accelerate these action items and get to the point where, you know, beyond the question of doing the normal leak surveys, but can begin to act proactively. Exactly what they mean by that, I mean, different people mean things, to identify threats that then need to be replaced.
So complete the DIMP first, which will identify the threats.
Yes, I would say.
Is that something that is, isn't that an ongoing thing, the DIMP?
Yeah,
is
of
it,
course.
Is there a beginning and an end to that?
Well, no, they have to set this up. So the requirements are that they perfect their knowledge and then continue to update it. And continuing to update it would amount to, you know, what their normal thing. You know, he's got a leak, okay. We have a leak on this segment, and we know what that segment's made of and whatever all that means. What MDU can tell you better than I can tell you what actions they need to complete the DIMP to where it's just sort of an ongoing updated picture of their system.
Is it possible that they need to do the DIMP, keep working on the DIMP, and as they find things, fix them? At the same, you know, fix them as they go, but they're still working on the DIMP, or does all the DIMP need to be done, the entire system
I
characterized,
don't think that doesn't
and then
all need to be done? No, it's the sort of thing that you could do a lot. I mean, if I suppose you could construct a program that were to say, all right, when they identify an area that does have an aldolay, for example, of the sort that you want to get rid of, they go ahead and replace it.
Mm-hmm.
And they recover that through a tracker.
So it could be that they're doing that right now. Maybe set the tracker aside again.
I don't know what they're doing right
that
now.
That they've done some of the DIMP and I've identified it, and now they've got some projects in 2017 and 18 that they think need to be replaced or addressed. Is that possible?
It's possible.
But you didn't see that evidence.
I didn't see anything that suggested that was the case.
Okay.
But there's not, I mean, it may be the case, in which case I would reassess my...
Mm-hmm. Your conclusion?
My conclusions about whether, you know, the program is justified at this point and whether it requires tracker recovery.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think that concludes my questions. Thanks. I think you've already addressed all the tracker issues that I had, so I don't need to bug you with that.
Okay, Mr. Sanderson. I'm sorry, Mr. Armstrong. Redirect. Apologize.
Thank you. I think all your testimony has been fleshed out a couple times by now. I just have a couple questions for you. In your review of the SSIP program and or mechanism, I understand there's a difference between the two of them, correct?
Correct.
Was an incident in Cleveland, North Dakota ever brought up as a justification for the SSIP?
Was not presented to me.
And then, do you still have PCD-2 in front of you?
Yes, I do.
When's the first time you ever saw that?
when Mr. Duras's rebuttal testimony was filed.
That was after your direct testimony.
That was after my direct testimony. I mean, what's the date on this? The date of filing of rebuttal testimony was the first time I saw it.
Were you asked to review the 2017 projects by staff?
No.
Thank you. That's all the questions I have.
Mr. Sanderson.
Thank you. I've got some follow-up for you. I believe you acknowledged in response to a question from Commissioner Crotius that certainly some early vintage Aldolay pipe poses a safety risk.
It is. It's susceptible to brittleness and cracking.
Okay. And then you also indicated that there are low-pressure replacement projects going on across the country for safety and reliability reasons.
They're going on in certain places, Illinois being the principal one that I'm aware of.
Okay. There's not a lot. You heard Mr. Darris's testimony where he said there's not a lot of low-pressure systems in the country. Would you agree with that?
No. I know a number of utilities that still operate low-pressure systems.
Now, let's get into this regular repairs and maintenance, because this is important, I believe important. You said normal repairs and maintenance that the company does should be covered as an O&M expense.
It is an O&M expense.
Certainly. And you also testified you're aware for decades Montana Dakota has done repair and replacement and maintenance projects.
I have to assume that. I mean, I haven't examined their records.
Can you identify any project prior to 2018, a repair or regular repair or maintenance project that has been held not to be reasonable and prudent and necessary?
I know of none.
Okay. But yet, the regular repair and maintenance projects in 2018, the seven they've identified, you're saying every single one of those is not reasonable, not prudent, and not necessary.
Wait a minute, what year?
2018.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the SIP projects are.
And you're aware they're repair and maintenance projects?
No, they're replacement projects.
Okay. And that gets back to how does those projects differ from replacement projects they had done years prior?
As I said, it's my understanding that gas utilities, and MDU is a gas utility and probably operates the same way. There are two reasons when a gas utility replaces a main. Either it's been repaired so many times that it's basically falling apart, or because you want to increase capacity, or because there's been excavation damage to it. And those are all, those are routine replacement projects. And they all happen because there's some damage has happened to the pipe, or the pipe capacity needs to be increased.
And on those routine repair and replacement projects that you'd deem normal and operating maintenance expense, those are recoverable in rate cases?
Yeah, so traditionally that's the way they're recovered.
Okay. And in this case, it's your opinion that the repair and replacement projects, the seven identified in 2018, are not ordinary and reasonable and necessary because they were identified in an SSIP program?
I don't know that any of those projects involve repairing a leak. All I know is that those are projects to replace existing facilities, the status of which, the nature and status of which MDU hasn't told me about.
And let's talk about that. You saw the PHMSA Integrity Management Program that Mr. Darris testified that identified 8 threat categories. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Leaks is just one of the various threat categories.
Well, that's true.
Okay. You're also aware from Montana Dakota's depreciation studies that you've reviewed in this case that they have steel pipe and facilities and infrastructure in place going back to at least 1916.
I've seen that they've testified that they apparently have records of vintages that old.
Okay. So you know some of their current infrastructure is over 100 years old as we sit here today.
Some of their current infrastructure could last another 100 years.
Okay. And so what you're saying is until there's a leak, no need to develop a plan or a procedure to fix it.
No, I did not say that at all.
Okay. Would Montana Dakota and Mr. Darris be in a better position to determine what projects are reasonable, necessary, and prudent as the Vice President of Gas Operations than you as an expert reviewing just some of the data?
No, not necessarily.
Did you testify earlier, overall, Montana Dakota's system is just fine? I wrote that down in quotes. Is that your opinion in this case?
Yeah, and that's mostly based on both the documents I examined and the testimony of Mr. Darris.
And so since it's just fine, Montana Dakota doesn't need to proceed with these replacement projects.
It is functioning just fine right now. There may or may not be a basis for undertaking these replacement projects.
One of the things in response to Commissioner Christman's questions, you said no doubt if they were to adopt a rate recovery mechanism for SSIP projects, it would reduce the rate cases.
It reduces one of the drivers of rate cases.
And yesterday you heard Commissioner Fedorchuk say this may come down to the appetite of the commission for the number of rate cases. So let's talk about that. You're being paid here by advocacy staff pursuant to a filing fee by the commission, correct? Or by the company?
That's my understanding.
Okay. And just roughly, do you know your total, what's going to be roughly the total bill for just your work in this case?
I don't know.
Well, what's your hourly rate for testifying?
$200.
And do you have, how much time have you spent prior to today going through documents and preparing direct and rebuttal testimony?
I'd have to go back and check my records. I can't answer that question.
You can't estimate that?
My billings today, the billings date for my time probably are in the neighborhood of $15,000 to $20,000.
And you're aware that the cost of a rate case that the company forwards to staff are ultimately passed on to North Dakota customers and ratepayers.
Yeah, no, I understand that. That's actually a fairly common way of funding regulatory proceedings in North America.
Okay. One of the things you testified to is if the testing the company is doing this year shows issues with the Aldelay pipe, it should be replaced.
If the testing shows that they have Aldelay pipe composed of the resin that was used for several years that turns out to create a potential for brittleness and cracking, then any vintages that were made with that resin should be replaced.
Okay. And what about, let me ask you this question, and it's more in the terms of a hypothetical. Let's say the testing that is being done in Eldridge this year, it may not be Aldelay pipe, but it shows the same type of brittleness and potential for cracking. Would you believe that would be pipe that would need to be replaced?
Yeah, that's that's a defect in polypropylene pipe. I'm not aware that there are other vintages or polymers that were used that have this tendency.
Yeah, certainly, and that's why testing of these various vintages is appropriate and necessary.
It's appropriate to find out what they have in their if they can't go back to their inventory records and determine whether they bought and or installed any of that particular type of Aldelay pipe, then the only way to find out if it's there is to test it.
And let's talk about that issue. And you had some responses to Commissioner Fedorchuk with regards to this not having records or these inventory records. You're aware this is not a problem that's novel to Montana, Dakota, and North Dakota.
I've encountered it with other gas utilities. As represented to me here, this is the worst case I've ever seen. There may be worse cases, but just in my experience, this is the worst case.
Or you're aware that the company serves the city of Minot with natural gas service?
Yeah, that's my understanding. Okay.
You're aware that the company did not install that system and yet bought it from another operator and took it over?
I wasn't aware of that, but...
Okay. But situations like that also establish why the company would not have the necessary records. Would you agree with that?
If that company didn't keep the records and they didn't pass them on with the sale, then yeah, that would be why they don't have the records.
And that maybe wasn't a fair question, but you're aware all of Montana Dakota's infrastructure was not installed by the company.
Yeah, that's probably true of almost every gas utility in the country as well.
Now, I want to talk about, you said two of the systems that you thought addressed this best were Massachusetts and Maryland.
I was saying these are good, thorough regulatory arrangements for dealing with systematic safety issues.
All right. And I want to get to the point of this timing. You know, why now or how long should this program go? And I'm, again, looking at your exhibit, KRP1, the 2017 Department of Energy study, and specifically on page 44, the Maryland section of that chart, and it's talking about Maryland PSC approving Baltimore Gas and Electric's $400 million 30-year stride plan. That they're Maryland's looking at this over a 30-year period.
In that case, the Baltimore Gas and Electric has a lot of cast iron pipe in the ground.
Well, and in fact, they're more concerned about the 42 miles of bare steel that must be replaced within 15 years, the 1,200 miles of cast iron they want replaced in 30 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry, was that a question?
It was more a direct question, but I think we're there. We got where we needed to go.
At this point, we're getting awfully repetitive.
I'm going to let it go. It's a little argumentative, but...
Now... One of the things I think, I don't know if it's been made clear, but this investment for replacement of pipe has no corresponding growth in revenue with it with respect to new customers added.
That's true.
And that's one of the things that is a reason for addressing these accelerated programs.
That is one of the reasons that for addressing this through a tracker mechanism.
And certainly, because if the company expand, the Bakken boom develops again, and Williston's expanding, and the company needs to make infrastructure improvements, there's often revenue growth with that to help offset the costs.
Well, those are additions for growth.
Certainly.
And they generate revenue.
One of the things you said on your response to one of the Commissioner Fedorchuk's questions is Montana Dakota needs to complete the DIMP model.
No, it needs to complete its DIMP program, which is getting information about the state of its system.
Would it be, well, you're aware they've had a DIMP model in place for a number of years and have run multiple DIMP models.
The model is just a data repository.
And you're also aware, looking at Mr. Darris's testimony, that the projects selected in for 2018 weren't just pulled out of thin air. I mean, there were risk ratio scores assigned to them.
Those risk ratios don't have anything to do with the actual nature of the pipe system. And I went over this in my direct testimony. If you look at the DIMP, you can tell that those are being generated by generic assumptions about the nature of various kinds of facilities.
And that, again, gets us to a position where you believe you're in a better position to determine reasonable, necessary, and prudence with respect to the 2018 projects than Mr. Darris.
I'm in a good position to determine whether the information that has been provided is sufficient to demonstrate prudency.
And you testified that other companies have mechanisms in place to recover Aldele A and low-pressure steel systems, correct?
There are some jurisdictions where tracker recovery of replacement of low-pressure systems is occurring. Those commissions have approved it.
Mr. Pavlovic, I have no further questions. Thank you.
Mr. Kaufman.
No questions.
Major.
No questions, sir.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Yeah, I have one. When you were conversing with Commissioner Fedorchuk and Commissioner Chrisman, I'm just trying to get to this. With Commissioner Fedorchuk, you were discussing what might make a tracker acceptable.
Okay? Yes.
Different
well,
attributes.
The characteristics of an appropriate
good,
tracker.
Okay, or a reasonable tracker. And then when Commissioner Chrisman asked you a question about that, your response was, well, that would be good. And I was just trying to figure out if you meant that's the plan, that's a good, like, oh, that would be good. That's something we ought to do, commission ought to do, or just that was better than the alternative tracker that it exists in the filing. And I don't know if you can remember that. I don't want to make the court reporter go back and find it. We can do that tomorrow if we have to. But
I speculate that the answer is yes, both that it would be good and that it would be an improvement over the tracker to the extent that is described in the tariff.
Well, and what I was wondering is your opinion that if all of the evidentiary support is met and this is something the commission wants to implement, that the tracker is the way to go as opposed to having it in base rates. That's what it sounded like to me when you said that would be good, and I wanted to clarify if that's true or not.
This is the issue. If it's in base rates, if you put it in base rates, then there are going to be more base rate cases. That's just a fact. You know, if the company's costs are, you know, staying constant and aren't changing, and the only thing that's happening is that you're having these safety replacements, then having the tracker would avoid. There wouldn't be any driver for a rate case unless somebody were to suspect that their costs had actually fallen gone down. But I don't know how that works in North Dakota.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That's all I have.
Okay. Council, I'm looking at the clock, and I'm thinking we probably don't have time to start and finish another witness yet today by 5. I know some people have some other obligations today.
By 5?
Yeah. Can we start and finish with somebody by 5, or can we even start part of a direct by 5, or should we just come back tomorrow? I think we're back on schedule or maybe even ahead of schedule.
We would prefer to come back tomorrow.
How many witnesses do you have?
I've got 3 left, and then FEA has their ROE and other issues expert as well left.
Okay. I don't see any reason why we can't get that done tomorrow. Is that okay with you?
I thought Mr. Pavlovic would be our shortest witness, to be honest with you.
Okay. Well, I'm thinking we'll get it done tomorrow. I mean, we've only got roughly 20 minutes here. So we'll adjourn for today. And then we'll start at 8:30. If you want, we can try to start a little earlier tomorrow.
We'll get through ours. I mean,
yeah, I don't. I think we'll get through everybody. We'll do what we have to do.
Sir, I talked to staff earlier. Would it be possible for Mr. Gorman to go first thing in the morning?
I don't really have a problem with that. All I know is our witnesses all have flights at 4:58 tomorrow. So
okay.
I would need them done by 2:30. The latest.
I'm fairly confident we can accomplish that. I don't think we're going to gain much by staying here another 20 minutes today.
Okay. I agree.
Okay.